I apologize on behalf of the department to keep you members waiting. Have you gathered your breath, colleagues from the department? Okay. So you were walking very fast. So, good morning, everybody. Welcome to this portfolio committee, to our guests, presenters, to those who are connecting to us via different mediums. You are all welcome. My name is Lisa Mangu. I'm chairing the session. You are most welcome. Our purpose of meeting today is really to engage with those who have shown interest in our marine pollution, prevention of pollution from ships amendment bill. As always, when we publish, we invite the public, stakeholders to show interest, and those of you who have shown interest and are presenting yourselves today, we truly appreciate your efforts. Democracy and parliamentary work without public participation is not complete, because all we do it on behalf of the public. And such an important piece of legislation, without your participation and your input, would not complete the picture. So never think that your making time to make either written comments or come physically, we take it lightly. We truly appreciate it. It enriches the process, and it assists us at the end of the day to come up with a piece of legislation that, to the best of our ability, can be able to address the needs on that particular sector, today being the marine sector. So you are most welcome. And I believe we are ready to go, Ms. Carlson. We have a requisite quorum and everything. Can we go?
Yes, can I first share the apologies, Mr. Mondo? There was an apology from Mr. McDonald, who had a family emergency this morning. We still have the apology from Mr. Sitolo, Mr. Zwane, as well as Mr. Sitole and Mr. May, who have medical matters to attend to.
All right. Thank you. We will note those apologies as such. Did you have a hand up, Colin? Okay, finish. You'll talk when you are done.
I was asking as to whether she did not receive one from Mrs.
Nolichu.
Ms. Mishati indicated now there is a written apology from Ms. Nolichu as well.
All right. It's okay. We will note those apologies, colleagues. And that tray reminds me of being in hospital when the medicine comes down in the alley. I'm trying to get my mind straight.
And Dr. Pierre Ribello is in London on the Green Hybrid Drive. We're going to start with Mr. Morgan Griffiths this morning from WESA. He is ready to present.
All right. Thank you very much. As I've already welcomed you, you should be ready. You must have been given the guide on how to go about it. You will introduce yourself, your organization, and whoever you need to. And please carry on until you will not, we won't interrupt you. We will engage with you once you are done. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just putting the screen sharing on. Good morning, committee. Thank you very much for this opportunity to present. My name is Morgan Griffith. I represent WESA, the Wildlife and Environment Society of South Africa. I'm the strategic lead dealing with our advocacy program. And I'm going to run through over the next 20 minutes just a little bit of introduction who WESA is and our locus standi in these matters, and then make some general comments about the bill, and then raise some suggestions in particular around the two annexes, and in direct submission of those. And there are a number of things that WESA would like to suggest are included into the bill, and we hope that this committee will consider those as we go forward. Messages coming up here. Can I just check that it is going through? There was a message saying something to do with mute. Okay, great. Right. So just to sort of, WESA is a 96-year-old organization. We aim to initiate and support high-impact environmental and conservation projects to promote public participation in caring for the earth. We are a membership-based organization, as well as having a strong staff body that's represented across the country. We act, educate, and advocate for conserving the Earth's vitality, diversity. There are a number of things that they're doing, but I've just highlighted three here in securing our protection and wise use of natural resources, acting as an environmental watchdog, and I've done that for most of my career, starting out with the advent of the environmental impact legislation back in 1998. And influencing policy and decision making. I hope to be able to do that today with all of you. WESA has been involved in legislation.
Let's bring the mic closer to you.
Sorry,
you're
not hearing.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. WESA has been involved in the development of legislation and conservation policies right since we started. In fact, WESA was an organization that started to bring around the national conservation and national parks. We are responsible for having brought about the establishment of Kruger National Park, Addo Elephant National Park, amongst others. We gave a lot of input into the development of the National Environmental Management Act, the Biodiversity Act, the Air Quality and the Water Act. So we've been involved in the legislation around dealing with those issues. And we've also had 14 years of participation in the Kuka and Port of Mankura IDZ and all the issues to do with shipping and industry and heavy industry that from that side. We also contributed to the Operation Pakisa plans. I spent 5 weeks working with members such as yourself developing that plan. And I must say, when they lock you up in a hotel for 5 weeks, you put on lots of kilos. I'll give you a warning if you haven't had that experience. WESA is also the implementer of the International Blue Flag Beaches and Marinas program in South Africa for the last 21 years, and that is a program that's been highlighting the development of tourism along the coastline, but also been monitoring water quality along our coastline for 21 years. And it's from that experience that we're able to talk on some of the waste issues affecting our marine environment. We have been also heavily involved in the development of the system of marine protected areas, calling for them and helping to defend them, in some cases through legal processes, as well as being involved in a number of seminal court cases, such as the Sand of the Wild Coast, which dealt a lot with public participation and the rights of communities to protect their marine environment, as what happened in Algoa Bay as well. Just from a personal viewpoint, I've been involved in a lot of sailing, years, over the years, and done a lot of work on research vessels and tall ships. So some of the comments that are coming through have come from that particular experience. Now, South Africa has an incredible marine biodiversity and heritage, and it forms an incredible part of our economy, particularly our tourism economy. I don't know if you know, but we've got over 136 different types of marine habitats. We've got 13,000 named marine species at the moment, and they're protected through a network of 46 marine protected areas. And we really have an extraordinary natural resource and wealth, and it is very worthy of protection. And that is why WESA would like to submit comments on this particular bill. To start off with our general comments, we're very supportive of this bill. It's absolutely fantastic to see that it's going on. We think it's coming about at a very appropriate time, particularly if we look at the amount of attention that's been placed on protecting our environment. And when I say that, it's not just for human benefit. The environment has the right to its own intrinsic value, and it's really important that we as custodians are protecting them. This bill does go a long way in terms of managing sewage waste and air emissions from marine shipping, and it's really great to see that this bill is there. We note the Section 3B and particularly the additions in the subclause in it. There's some really good elements that are coming through, and then it's changing the landscape to doing with shipping. And if you spend some time in harbors or out at sea or on the shipping roads, you'll notice a lot of things that go, wait a moment, why is that smoke coming out? That can't be right. Why is that stuff being dumped overboard? When you see water coming out of the cooling systems like this, you're going, it shouldn't be green. There shouldn't be oil coming out of those systems. It's great to see that these regs will be dealing with a lot of that. We would like to make some particular comments now, first of all starting around Annex 4, which deals with really with sewage. Our first issue is with Regulation 2.1. That regulation says this bill is only going to apply to ships that are involved in international waters. That is to say, in terms of the yellow arrow between IEEZ and our neighbours and such like. WESA's got a concern that it doesn't cover our shipping in terms of moving just within our EEZ, and we've got a lot of big fishing vessels as well as local container transports that move just within our EEZ, as well as particularly for fishing vessels that move between our EEZ and into the high seas, as well as our vessels, both research and fishing and mineral exploratory, that are moving between our EEZ, crossing the high seas, and re-entering the EEZs around our islands. So there's a gap in the legislation there. And so the remedy that we are suggesting is that this regulation then also include voyages within and between SA territorial waters and between our waters and the high seas. We have a second concern that the threshold only applies to ships above 400 tons, gross tonnage. I'm just going to refer to it as tons going forward. That's quite a big ship, and there are quite a few smaller vessels, fishing vessels, particularly tuna boats, chocker boats, that fall under that 400. And WESA is making the recommendation that it apply down to 100 gross tons. Below that, I think a lot of the machinery and the systems and things that would need to be fitted either into brand new vessels, into retrofitted, and I see the bill clearly differentiates what's needed in those two classes of vessels. Some of the things might just be too difficult to fit in terms of the entire weight structure of those boats. For instance, some of our largest yachts in the country would be getting close to 100 tons from the side there. Our third concern is inorganics and solids in sewage aren't being adequately dealt with. They can also be discharged within the sewage. And hence our recommendation there is focusing on removing those inorganics and solids from the sewage. Now bearing in mind, the sewage here is typically just your black water, your grey water from your kitchens, your terms of your waste and such like.
is being already dealt with in other parts by legislation in terms of food scraps, your bottles, your cans, and things like that. There's legislation that really deals with how that that matter is really dealt with. I'm just noting, if you haven't heard, MSC Cruise Lines were recently fined $25 million US dollars for throwing their bags of garbage out into the seas or the Caribbean. They were doing it early in the morning, 3 o'clock, hoping that their guests above were not looking at them, but somebody recorded them doing it, and $25 million US dollar fine for that cruise company. Now, it might seem that this request, the remedy that we're proposing, it might seem overly onerous, but most of us are quite familiar with bins in toilets. It's your hygiene products, your condoms, things like that. Those are solids that you don't actually want being ejected out with the sewage stream. And in fact, most trips I think would be quite happy to do it, because those are the sort of things that block up your system anyway. And if you've had any experience working on ships, that you know that once you start getting into those pipes and dealing with, it's actually quite a mission to deal with. So I don't think there'll be too much resistance in terms of bringing this in. Obviously your bigger vessels have got a bigger problem to deal with, but they've got small space to for your separation. So we feel it's a mechanism that would be fairly easy to put in. We're also suggesting that the sewage be macerated before it's actually disposed of into the sea. And there already are bits of legislation that deal with what are the distances out to sea that you may only eject your sewage out. For instance, you can't eject your sewage out into the harbour or within 1 nautical mile of the coastline. And if you think that that might be a difficult thing to achieve, many of you have probably got under kitchen sink waste macerators. They're small things, they're quite easy to deal with, they're fairly easy to fit in. Moving on to Annex 6, which deals with the prevention of air pollution from ships. I'd just like to start off noting that air pollution from ships amounts to nearly 3% of the total greenhouse gases emissions around the planet. And that might not seem a great deal, but in terms of tonnage and the fact that our shipping is growing and a lot more commerce is expected to happen over the next 20 years, it is an issue that is worth dealing with. And these regulations that are coming in to deal with the air emissions are crucial for it, and we're really glad to see that that has been brought about. Again, we're concerned that the threshold is set too high in terms of those, the definition of ships that this regulation will apply to is 400 and above, and we feel again it should be brought down to 100 gross tonnage. See, I've just been muted. I see I'm full. Okay, where's Alton? You still hear me? I'm good. I'm just getting all sorts of messages coming up on the side here. Thank you. We note also that Regulation 5.2 does provide the space for allowing the change in these regulations around 400 tons. I think the regulation refers to and setting other appropriate measures for ships below 400 tons. So we feel that in terms of that particular clause, in fact, why not just set it at 100 as the same as Annex 4? Now, what's really important for WESA, because it's an emerging issue and we've been starting to see the deleterious impacts around our coastline, what's currently not in the bill, and we see it as a gap. And in the next couple of slides, I'm going to advocate for why we should bring in some regulations around noise pollution, marine noise pollution, into this bill while they have the opportunity to do so. So first of all, noting that the bill is providing, is giving effect to this international convention. And we note that one of the primary things is dealing with prevention of pollution and provide for matters connected herewith. So already within that convention, and within this bill, there's a space to be able to deal, we think, with this issue. Further moving on, our constitution provides the right for everybody to have an environment that's not harmful to their well-being and to have the environment protected for the benefit of the present and future generations through reasonable legislative and other measures. I don't think I need to quote more. You have the business of law and law making, And it's very clear in our constitution that we need to protect the environment. Further, we've got the National Environmental Management Act that places a duty of care on every single person. And that is not just the environmentalists in the room. It is the transport, whether you are a ship owner, a ship's captain, somebody working on the ship, someone in the Department of Transport, everybody has the duty of care. So that particular act, again, provides an opportunity to deal with this issue. Now, anthropogenic undersea noise is a growing problem and a threat to marine life. And the next couple of slides, I'm just going to explain why and hence the justification for it. And we're noting that at the moment, we don't have any legislation that deals with this growing problem. It's not a new problem. It's been going on for as long as we've had motorized shipping and undersea mining. But it's an issue that's come to the fore in terms of the intensity, the amount of shipping, and the fact that we now are observing real deleterious impacts on our marine environment. And some of those impacts are actually affecting our fishing industry. So what really am I talking about when I'm talking about marine noise? And I do need to distinguish that there is natural noise and there is anthropogenic or human-induced noise. So your natural noises would be your whale song and your sonar emitted by seals and dolphins. It's your waves breaking. It's natural undersea tectonic movements. It's the effect of wind on the water, lightning hitting it. So you've got a number of these natural elements. Your water currents produce low background noise. We humans have added a great deal of noise over and above that. Everything from your seismic surveyors, your sonar, and that is everything from your small fishing vessels that are going out to your military sonar, whether you're even running a small yacht engine, and I've been quite guilty of that, to a jet ski out there, or the massive engine noise produced by our boats. I don't know if any of you are scuba divers or free divers have been under the water when you've heard a vessel going past, even just a small rubber ducky. It's the equivalent of standing next at the end of the Cape Town runway and having a jet land in above you. That's the level of noise that's experienced by even just one of those small boats. To hear one of the massive 3,000-unit container ships come steaming past, it is like being right next to the speakers in a pop concert. It is an unbelievable level of noise that is there. Just to further to give you a bit of insight, if you're looking down at the bottom where those whales are, and I hope you can see it or whether it's coming up on your screens, our natural noise is in that frequency and the decibel range around about 55 to 85 degrees, and that's quite comfortable for human hearing. Above that, take a look at jet skis, 125. Avoidance around about there, fishing trawlers, 158. So tanker, 169, a super tanker, 340 meters. That 190 decibel is the level of if you're standing next to a jet, and if you've got to fly back to Joburg or whatever the case over the next couple of days, if you were standing next to the jet engines, that's 190 decibels. Above that, you can see some of the air guns, some of the really big tankers, some of the military or very active sonar. And those levels of decibel levels, if you can think about just the impact in your own ears and how it stuns you under the water, it feels even worse because it doesn't just affect your eardrums. As a human, you feel it in all of your body tissues. And this noise is not just within a very small frequency band. It's quite an extensive frequency band, and the noise overlaps the entire known frequency of hearing in all marine animals that we understand at the moment. So everything going down to some of your invertebrates, to give an example, mantis shrimp, to your fish, to your dolphins and whales, which are at the high end. So it's right over. So it's not a case of, okay, well, let's try and just get rid of ships making a noise in this particular band because that's where your animal life is listening to. This noise, anthropogenic noise, comes right across. So what are some of the impacts? So why is marine noise important? A lot of marine organisms use sound for navigation. I think you're all quite familiar how dolphins and whales, they produce sonar in terms of navigating. finding food, spanning their food. They use it in territorial defense. So if you've been underwater, you will have heard the number of different noises that fish make in terms of talking to each other. Grunter, I mean, one of our best fishing species, grunter, because they make that noise. They communicate with each other with that particular noise. It's for all manner of socializing and attracting mates. So this is background noise, just like we humans use sound and speech to communicate and deal with a lot of things. So there's a vast amount of animals utilizing noise. Just to give you an example, we've got sperm whales that are off our coastline. You might not see them down here in Cape Town. If you go really far out down south, you might see them. But particularly where I come from, Durban, they're off in the warm water areas. These animals are using to navigate through sonar. They use sonar to find their prey, sometimes down at 1,000 meters in the blackness alone, there's no light. They use it to find it. They're able to use sound enough, at a concentration enough to stun their squid prey. They use it for socializing, talking, attracting mates. The males use sound, slapping the ocean in order to create sound to intimidate their rivals, as well as using whale song in order to defend their territory. So you can see there's quite a range of what they use sound for, just like what we humans do. And what are some of the impacts now that the human-induced or created noise is having on this environment? Well, the one is stress. I think if any of you stood next to some really loud music speakers, that intensity, I think you feel a stress, a body stress, a hearing stress, an emotional stress. There's also the physical injury both to ear spaces, so your cetaceans, your dolphins, whales, as well as your pinnipeds, which are your seals from that side, as well as to the air or fluid-filled spaces within animals, particularly fish. So some of this high-intensity noise and bursts of noise can actually burst the air bladders of fish. So this is why sometimes when you see seismic surveys happening on our country, you will often find dead fish in the wake, because those sound intensities have basically caused the insides to explode. And again, that death injury, as well as to dolphins and whales and seals, but also to your shark, is known as barotrauma. Further to that, it's creating a background fog of noise. Again, to use the example of a pop concert, when that music is going, you can't be talking to the person next to you. It cuts out your ability to communicate. And so this fog of noise, particularly loud noise, is now blanketing out nature's ability to hear itself and conduct its normal activities. So it has been noted in various papers where there's a great deal of noise, particularly coming from high-intensity large shipping, that fishing populations have moved from one area to the other, and that has an impact on our fishing, particularly our artisanal fishing industry. As fish move, as other organisms move, that has an impact on the entire food chain. So a lot of really intense deep sea noise is having an impact on the phytoplankton of our oceans. Now that's basically the grass of the oceans. The sound waves destroying them, they're causing the bodies of these tiny little microscopic organisms to break apart, and that is the first element of the food chain. If they're not there, then they're the food for the smallest, our baby anchovies, for instance. So that has an impact on that. So now we're starting to see an impact on our anchovies, our sardines, all our game fishing and our bigger fishing that derives off them now are being denied a food source. So there's an ecological impact, a cascading impact that we need to be aware of what's happening. To give you an example, this is a picture right about 2006 of the penguin colony at St. Croix down in Algoa Bay. I didn't take this picture, but I started sailing around those islands around about this time. There were 20,000 breeding pairs of penguins on the island. This is the picture today. We're down to less than 2,000 breeding pairs of penguins. A lot of that has been caused by the collapse of the fishing industry in that area. But around about 2016, there were around about 5,000 breeding pairs left. And then we brought in the bunkering ship-to-ship bunkering situation in Algoa Bay. And that brought about a massive increase in amount of noise that was in bay. It drove the fish out of the bay, and that collapsed the pelagic colonies. Now, you might say, well, listen, these birds are out to sea already. What does that mean for us? Well, they're pointing to whole system-wide collapse of the system. Right? So you're seeing something that's very visible, but what you're not seeing is that shipping noise has led to a major collapse of our fishing industry. It's driven the fish away. It's destroyed their food source. And that has a human economic impact, which might be of more interest to you. So what are some of the remedies that Wesse is suggesting in terms of dealing with this? Well, the first, we believe, in terms of applying the precautionary principle, is to ensure that noise levels are not harmful. And we can remedy the situation by, one, bringing into this bill effective noise regulations that mitigate or eliminate intense noise. We know you're not going to be able to eliminate all, but at least you can try and mitigate it down through behavioral changes, and I'll bring those into a moment, or some structural changes, that is to say, changes to the actual ships themselves. What you might not be aware of is a military sonar is of particular high levels of intensity, and they have particularly deleterious impacts. And we are suggesting that this bill also accommodate that military sonar also fall under this, but recognizing that outside of imminent and active conflict, we recognize that this country needs to defend itself through even an international aggressor or through concerted criminal activities. And our Navy and our Marine and Ocean Branch are fighting a battle out there with illegal fishing vessels. We believe that military sonar should also be subject to these noise regulations. We believe that seismic testing also should be brought under them and better mitigated and controlled. At the moment, they aren't being properly managed, and they're having this really serious impact. The Save the Wild Coast court case, the judge there found, not just in terms of public participation, inadequacies of that environmental impact assessment and the Minister of Mineral and Energy Affairs' decisions on it, but also the fact that they weren't considering the broader environmental impacts that noise, the seismic noise, was having on our oceans, but also the economies and the people that live off fishing. And finally, we believe that there should be space for low noise areas. And these are areas where really low noise levels are set. That's not to say no shipping, no noise, no jet skis. We're not calling for an exclusion zone. But what we are saying, and it has been applied in other parts of the world quite successfully, and that in these areas, defined areas, the ships are required to slow down, that they're not allowed to undertake certain maybe blasting activities, right? Or perhaps testing of certain noise machinery. So we recognize that ships, for instance, Algoa Bay. In fact, I think my next slide brings it up. No, not quite. I'll come into the noise level a little bit. But within these noise areas, there's a set decibel level. And it is very easy to achieve. We're not asking for the impossible or asking for a close down in business. But at the same time, to give you an analogous example, around hospitals, you typically have slower speed limits. You also have noise limits. Supposedly, our taxis are not meant to be hooting around hospitals, but you might have experienced that not is always the case. But those are meant to be low noise areas as well. The International Maritime Organization, they've been researching and promoting noise reduction solutions and looking at the comments and the research and the proposals and the guidelines that are coming out of it. It looks like there's a trajectory of noise regulation coming into their guidelines and enforced regulations in terms of our shipping falling under the governance of the IMO. So it's coming. Noise regulation are definitely coming in terms of international legislative space, and this bill provides an opportunity to really get into the fore of that. the idea, and see some of the clauses relate to how many years certain ships need to have achieved certain of the sewage and the air emission standards that are proposed by the bill. So there's an incremental element within this bill, and we leave in the same way that there can be an incremental noise reduction strategies that are provided for in this bill. So the IMO is already promoting noise reduction through ship design, and just if you're looking at the slide there, noise comes from all sorts of things, and not just the propeller noise and the engine noise, there's machinery noise, there's the shape of the boat itself creates a noise wake. And considering all the other elements of design of a ship, hulls and shapes and lengths can be designed, at least particular ships that are being built or perhaps being altered or lengthened to bring about noise reduction strategies. And so these include design of propulsion systems, machinery noise, particularly the propeller noise. And I understand there's some really technical stuff around how you design a propeller in terms of catavation, speed, how it fits to the length of a boat, but there are ways to reduce noise on propellers. And then further, there's traffic control measures, and these are being quite widely, I'm not so widely, have been quite successfully used in a number of ports already. I think New Zealand and some European areas, as well as some US areas, are now effectively using traffic control to mitigate noise. Particularly these are speed reduction, right, for a particular ship. So for instance, a ship needs to slow down to a certain speed before it approaches a coastline, before it enters a harbor. And one recognizes that ship movements are crucial in terms of speed and meeting their allotted slots and things. So we recognize that that there are lots of issues to do with that, but we feel it is being successfully implemented already, as well as at a traffic control level, and that is to say how you manage a number of ships within an area. So it might be managing ships as they move around the South African coastline so that we don't have as many ships entering a particular port I'm not going to say a bay, because sometimes in emergency situations, a lot of boats, particularly smaller vessels, move into a bay in order to the safety, and we definitely are not saying that those sort of safety issues should not happen in those areas. But by keeping a better control of the entire traffic in the area, we can reduce noise levels. So to give an example, I'll go bay. I've got a little bit more experience about this. I'm just trying to see if I can get a little pointer. And going on the side there, you've got the St. Croix Islands over here, you've got the Bird Island complex, Port of Nkura. As I said, I started working on the EIA from the beginning of this in 2004, right through the construction, witnessed the opening of that harbor and worked on the Environmental Monitoring Committee for 14 years as we led through the whole process of developing that port and all the facilities and the traffic control. And then a little bit further down, you've got the long-standing port of Port Elizabeth down there. So to give you an idea in terms of a low-noise area, at the moment you've got a great deal of shipping that's moving in and out of those two ports, particularly in the area around here, and you've got the shipping node here. Were this to be, for instance, this area to be declared a low-noise area, some of the strategies would be slowing of ships down into this area, marshalling them so that fewer ships are arriving at the same time. But obviously, they've got to meet their time slotments, offloading cargo. We understand that perfectly. But instead of having many ships steaming fast in and out, you can slow your traffic and better manage your traffic down. And that's a fairly simple thing for Transnet to organize and for SAMHSA to be monitoring. Just in some concluding comments, there's a lot of legislation that's already out there in terms of waste management and pollution control, and I must tell you that it's failing. It is failing dismally. For 21 years, WETSA has been collecting water quality data along our coastline. You might have heard that recently there were a number of blue flag beaches at waters, quite a lot in the paper. Water quality along our coastline is failing, and it's failing badly. It's rapidly going down, and it is a threat to our fishing, our human welfare, and our tourism businesses at the moment. You might be aware that a lot of Durban at the moment, they're not getting any blue flags. Basically, you cannot swim in the water there without getting sick. There's so much sewage in the water that's there. In Cape Town, I don't believe it's safe to swim in False Bay or off here on the Atlantic coastline at all during your winter period. Your E. coli levels are so high, you've got less than one in 1,000 chance of getting diarrhea, a skin infection, ear infection, and such like. Our water quality is really bad. This legislation has an opportunity to help to deal with it, and it's really grateful that we're seeing these changes being made. Our last comment is that this bill requires the CHIPS report in terms of its compliance with it, and that is really good to see. But we notice that most legislation in this country, without proper compliance and enforcement and governance around it, legislation is just paper. I really wouldn't like to see this bill to be another paper tiger. So WESA would call for an additional clause that requires that the compliance data and reports be made publicly available through a portal either on Department of Transport or Transnet or SAMHSA or all three, so that ships can be monitored by the public. A name and shame game. And that's crucial because we recognize that our authorities are suffering from a lack of capacity. Organizations such as SANCOB, Animal Justice and others, we are looking at these things. We're keeping a monitoring of them. And we are able to then look at them and say, hey, there's a problem developing. These ships are not complying. Why are they not complying? What do they need to do to comply? And it promotes governance at a broader scale. There's incredible technology that's coming out. I don't know if you're aware of it, but a number of ships are even looking at using these pillars. They might just look like tubes, but they're very effective sailing mechanisms to reduce the amount of fuel that ships have to utilize moving around the planet in terms of cutting down greenhouse. There's incredible technology and innovation in space that is coming around. And this bill is an opportunity to contribute to that, and particularly feel that the submissions that we have made are worthy of consideration in bringing about some of those changes and adding to what it is. So thank you so much for this opportunity to present. I'm very willing to answer any questions you may have to the best of my ability. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Griffiths. We appreciate your input. But regarding your last comment, there is no input, there is no suggestion that is not worth considering. So, as I said, never feel like what you are doing is just a tick box exercise. We take every input very seriously, and obviously we then apply our minds. So thank you so much. Colleagues, there is a presentation. May I just, as a way of introduction, as we are going to allow for engagement, that we limit ourselves rather to asking questions of clarity to the suggestions, and because at the end of the day we will have an opportunity to deliberate amongst ourselves what we think can be used and what we think is not really useful. So let's use this exercise rather than try and oppose what they are saying or say no, but rather seek clarity so that when we do apply our minds, we are clear on what the proposals were actually saying. So we have also a capable team of our state law advisors and parliamentary legal services. Please, if you'd like to ask anything, feel free. Department, I know that at this time you are more observers, it's a parliamentary process, but if you really feel strongly to ask something, we will not close you outside. I will start with the colleagues, honorable members. Let me see if there is anybody. I recognize Honorable Hunsinger, Honorable Shabangu, Honorable Kumalo, in that order as a first round. You will take all of the questions, Mr. Griffiths, and then you will have an opportunity to respond to all of them. Honorable Hunsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Mr. Griffiths, for a really interesting and educational submission. I would like to ask four questions and a fifth one around just maybe comment. First one is about your submission of wanting to reduce the maximum size tonnage of a ship within the suggested framework of restriction around waste and management thereof. I was happy to see that, you know, you don't find it good to have levels 400 tons and up, but that you would suggest that this be lowered to 100 tons and up. Why not restrict it in any case? In other words, you know, what would allow a ship of 99 tons then to be okay, but it's a transgression for 100 tons, if the principle of reduction around 400 tons should apply in your thinking? The second one, where you spent a lot of time on noise pollution or marine pollution, you mentioned, and your wording around that was a trajectory, and this is referring to the IMO, a trajectory of noise regulation coming into the space, which to me sounds like it's not in the space already. So who are the forerunners of the attempt to control noise and marine noise pollution? And what is the thinking around that? Because a lot of this, as you also expressed, is sonic in effect. So it's not so much the sound, but the impact in terms of the waves, wavelengths and the intensity thereof. So it's not something you necessarily hear. So how would you measure and how would you manage this? The third one was a remark around what I pick up as your hesitance in wanting to include exclusion zones. So I'm asking you the direct question, why the hesitance? You know, if there's a necessity to have exclusion zones, in other words, where access is not allowed at all, why don't we have that? Why, through our research, these areas cannot be identified and then declared as such? The fourth question is around speed reduction, the Algoa Bay scenario, which in a way disappointingly to me pointed at reasons around like human justification instead of, you know, sea life justification, simply because there are cities at the coastline, you know, there were particular restrictions, which, you know, to me is the wrong sort of motive around this. And the last question is around enforcement. Your suggestion of having a blacklist type of name and shame type of enforcement, or, you know, an approach. We've also had experiences in other entities of a fine system. But you often find yourself that, you know, irrespective of the fine, it's still cheaper to pay the fine and have access. So it's not proven to be effective and efficient. What other international examples are there that are more effective that we should rather consider than to have a, you know, traffic law enforcement approach of fines? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, colleague. Honourable Samuel. Thank you, Chair. Let me also echo the very sentiment that has been echoed by my colleague with regard to the presentation. I'm not feeling well. What measures do you want to, the government to take on the ships that transgresses the law of the country with regard to the pollution of seas, taking into account that one MNC was heavily fined for throwing garbage in the sea? Are you preventing pollution on oceans only? What about other species that die because of waste and air pollution in the big oceans in South Africa? in the big dams in South Africa. You intend doing away with machinery or ships that make a lot of noise in the seas? If yes, how much would this cost and who will incur the expenses? Traffic officers that control the flow of the ship in the seas, are they up to standard? Do they not take bribery like the ones working on our potholes, roads in South Africa? Are they not contributing to the pollution of air in our seas by taking bribes from the owners of the ships? Thank you very much.
Thank you, colleague. Honorable Kumalo.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also say that the presentation is very much educational, and let us welcome it. Chair, I will try and confine myself on your guidance to say, rather than asking a lot of questions, let us at least say something that we think maybe it will be added up going forward. My colleague has made mention of what we have seen already about what has been happening on our seas, of which we always thinking of people that working underwater. If we're looking at all these data, it is being deep there. I was just concerned when I was hearing the presenter made mention of even the tiny underwater noise that can affect the human body or the human being. That maybe going forward, there will be some measures, including the other noises that is happening, because we cannot, I mean, deny the fact that, as you said earlier on, that the shipping is moving in and out, of which I think it's good because it contributes to the economy as well. That maybe going forward, there will be something that will be made to control and even assist people that are directly affected beyond their involvement in that situation. Because as we sitted here, there are people that have been affected, they are hearing noises when they're working in the mines long ago, but they're still affected. I think this presentation may be going forward, it will have some measures to say how are they going to be assisted, that they were there, but being affected by this noise, there are measures that will assist them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, colleagues. I wanted you to respond, but I'm concerned that the colleague who had asked some question is not feeling very well, so he has stepped out, so I would rather give him an opportunity so that when you respond, at least he's here, unless he can't. So while we're waiting for him, I'll allow somebody else just to add on in the name of Honorable Ramadwa, just to add on question or comments, and then we will take it from there, if you just bear with us, Mr. Griffith. Honorable Ramadwa.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Dimachelon. Honorable Chairperson, let me also join my colleagues who are appreciating the presentation, because it's so informative. Chairperson, mine is just a question for clarity. The presenter indicated that there is a gap in the legislation. So we would like him to indicate and be specific, not to generalize, which are those gaps that are not there in the legislation that must be, that is proposing them to be filled. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. please go ahead and respond to the best you can where you think it's outside your scope. I don't want to limit you. You may leave those ones. Where there are comments, you may just note the comments. Mr. Griffiths.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm delighted with the questions. It always means people are listening to you and trying to understand deep, and I'm appreciative of that. The first question to the first member who asked, why not all tonnage? I was reviewing the entire set of legislation, and there are a number of elements that are proposed in there that are not simple to achieve. On a land-based system, you've got space, you've got opportunity to deal with things, particularly around sewage business. On a boat, you've often got a limited space. So, for instance, part of the regs talks about the size of tanks, and there's an understanding that if you've got a tank on a boat with a liquid in it, that creates an instability platform. It's a risk to the boat. So part of my experience with shipping and boats is understanding that in terms of additional machinery and tanks in order to deal with things like that, there's a limitation on what the size of the boat and what it can deal with. Hence, when Smaya made the comment around putting on a macerators onto your sewage thing, we believe it's a simple thing to achieve because it typically is a small element, probably no more in terms of wiring, battery capacity, and actual size and fitment in terms of and water security. It's a thing that can be fairly easily achieved, both on a small boat and on a bigger boat. Looking at the size of a boat, understanding some of the sizes and generally the sizes of our boats, so particularly that applying in a commercial sense, 100 tons is the kind of a boat that has probably got enough space, engine capacity, generator capacity, and space to deal with most of the issues, not just with what we're proposing, but a lot of what the rest of the build is in. So while we would love it for all ships to be put in, for some it's just not viable on the side of things. But noise regulations can apply to a rubber ducky. And for an argument saying in a low noise area, you can have a limitation of the speed. We already have no wake zones in some areas, for instance. But you wouldn't require a seated toilet with a maceration device on a rubber ducky or jet ski at sort of the scale. So other members of your department who've got far more understanding of the technical size of ships, they might say, well, look, 100 is too big, or actually we could drop it. Just my general sense is 100 is a fairly good size vessel to be able to accommodate the realistic things that we would want them to be able to deal with. To the second, the question was around trajectory and who were some of the front runners. I mentioned them, New Zealand, in some of their ports have been, New Zealand itself, I understand some of the European countries. Unfortunately, in the paper that I was reading around the European, it didn't mention exactly which companies, which ports, which countries were applying it. The comments were in a general sense that these have been happening. And so that's an oversight of not knowing exactly which one. Certainly in the States, they have, particularly in some of the Great Lake areas, some of the counties there have been employing some of the noise reduction strategies and such like, particularly to protect their salmon stocks and such like. How to measure sound? Well, you can have two devices. One is stationary devices, and already we've got transducers already placed around our coastline. Some of them are already measuring noise for our geoscience network. So in some ways, there is a bit of a network that really can support some of the elements. I think Port of Ngqura, for instance, has got noise monitoring already as part of the environmental program on the side. There's a lot of scientific instruments, particularly looking for transducers that are measuring fish and dolphin and whale tracking devices. So there is a network that could even be piggybacked onward. But it's fairly easy and simple to have those devices. And then, of course, you can have those used on your sea fisheries vessels, like the Griffiths and Yenge. They can have a hydrophone that could be deployed on a basis at a certain time, at a certain place, and monitoring. Or whether they feel that a certain area or certain ships going past, they can measure that noise. And it's a fairly easy system. Of course, it's the protocol and the fairness of how you measure it so that it is legally and objectively defensible. But those protocols are fairly easy to develop. Why the hesitancy about low noise areas? It's not so much a hesitancy, I'm just trying to find the right way to express it to you in a way that kind of, where this is coming from an environmental sense, so we've got the environmental concern, but we recognize that it, people, environment, economies, these things are all interconnected, and for many people who may not be, and if I'm being discriminatory in the sense of thinking that you might not know a lot of environmental issues, my suspicion is that you know a lot more about economics and economies around shipping and transport, and you might have a better sense and hence trying to propose it in terms that you might be more familiar with. The concept is working in various parts of the world. Some of it is on trial basis, some of it is already in terms of local bylaws, particularly some of the Great Lakes types of things. It's a viable mechanism, and I believe it's a mechanism that can be employed without having a deleterious economic impact. And we know that it's a really big concern for South Africans at this point. Part of why I express it in these economic and human terms is I recognize that as much as I would love the environment to have its own voice and its own legal right, and by the way, there's a space around nature rights and things that are coming in, there's a recognition that we do need to do some balances on the side of things. And hence, my expressing this way is also not to get the backup of the shipping industry that might feel, hey, this is another whole bunch of green stuff that's being foisted on them that's going to cut down on their profit margin. That's why I've been saying all along, I think these are things that are justifiable, reasonable, and are economic to bring in from the side. Then in terms of enforcement, of fines and system and naming and shaming. So the bill already proposes a level of fines for transgression and non-compliance. And I think some of those fine levels are fairly adequate. They're in the millions. They're not the 50,000 rand for dumping constantly along the coastline. So I think the fine level is appropriate. It does also talk about how those fines will incrementally be adjusted over time period. That's really good to see. So if the legislation comes in now, it's 5 billion, and 30 years from now, it's still 5 billion, and that's pocket change on the side. The issue around having that portal was made as a way that information around compliance of our shipping companies, that then it's in the public eye, so that the public eye can contribute to the compliance enforcement measures of our statutory and enforcement bodies. There are organizations that monitor everything from social surveying around illegal trade in parrots, for instance, on the internet. Just as there are people who support our crime intelligence by monitoring for child exploitation on the web, by having the information put on a portal, publicly available portal, organizations such as WENSA and SAMCOB can go online and take a look at, hey, we observe something, while members of the public are reporting, let's take a look at that ship. Is it in compliance? Why is it in compliance? Department, we've noted that ship is non-compliant. Last year they should have met some of the recommissioning things that are set out in the bill. Why haven't they done so? It's a point of engagement with itself. So it's not that WESA or my colleagues are looking to supplant the statutory and the enforcement obligations of any body. It's a way of aiding and seeing what's going on. It's good governance. I hope I've addressed the members' questions adequately then. I see you've come back, sir. I hope you're feeling better. Your first question is around enforcement and measuring and who does it and who does defining. It's not WESA's space to go around issuing fines. As much as I'd like to sometimes, I'll give you that. There are good bodies that are already looking at things. Your department has its own compliance issues. SAMHSA does. Transnet itself does have good monitoring and enforcement capabilities, and I've witnessed that and been part of that through the Kucha Environmental Monitoring Committee on the side. SAMHSA itself is also performing a great function in terms of some of those monitoring and enforcement issues on that, and I think they provide, at this stage, quite an adequate monitoring and enforcement compliance Is the intention to do away with all ship noise? No, that's certainly not our intention. I don't think it would be a viable option. What we are saying is that there are ships that are being designed at the moment that aren't taking into account the impact that noise is having on the marine environment, and they can be better designed. Ships that are needing to be retrofitted, so for instance, noise dampening can be put in. So for instance, on your car, you know that your engine is mounted on rubber shocks to your body frame in order to cut down the vibration and the noise that you feel sitting inside the cab. Most ships don't have that, right? Everything is welded, everything's solid, it doesn't come apart. But you can install shock absorbers that cut down on noise, and I know that because I did that in my own yacht. We had shock absorbers because a small fiberglass boat, you can't have it being shaken constantly to pieces by an old 9-horsepower engine. So there are ways to retrofit and improve the noise reduction levels of a boat, as well as through some of the behavioral aspects. And that relates to your third question. The ship traffic control, that's done by SAMHSA as well as your ports authorities, and they do keep a very close watch over your shipping, particularly where it's entering port areas from the side of things. Yes, they don't have much control of international shipping passing through our EEZ and around the country and not stopping at our ports. So that is a problem, but if we've got transducers out there and we're noting that certain ships are producing unacceptable levels of noise, it is well within SAMHSA's right as the Maritime Safety Authority to then contact those shipping companies, and they're able to do so and say, listen, you've got a problem, or you are causing such damage from now on, you may not travel through our EEZ in terms of protecting our fish stocks and our natural environment. So, yes, is there bribery and corruption? There is. It's a problem in South Africa. I haven't had lots of any experience. In fact, nothing really to comment. It's going with knowledge where it's definitely going on within SAMHSA or Transnet. My experience of Transnet and SAMHSA is that they've been pretty on the ball and they're pretty strict. I don't have my yacht license paid up at the end of the year. I take my yacht out of the harbour. I'm not allowed to bring it back in. Or I may not leave. And they're pretty severe. They can confiscate a ship. They can tie it up at anchor. There's nothing you can do about it. You'll forfeit your boat if you contravene SAMHSA or Transnet requirements. A small thing of enforcement, which was very effectively employed in the port of Port Elizabeth, was there the environmental department insisted that fishing vessels that were coming back to land their catches, the first thing they took off the boat was their bags of rubbish. If a boat with a crew of 100 had been out to sea for a week and they were taking one black bag of rubbish for that whole week and depositing that on that, Transnet there was saying, you have been illegally dumping at sea. You're not landing your catch at any South African port. Well, only one or two chopper boats pulled that one. The rest very quickly all got in line. They had an incredible impact. And I noticeably saw the difference in terms of the amount of rubbish that was being tossed out at sea and washing up on our beaches. And it was really effective. It was really good on Transnet on that side. Ma'am, just to note your comments, thank you very much. It's really good to hear that there is a concern, and there certainly is. There are deleterious human impacts. In terms of people experiencing noise and being injured by them, either as a worker or as a member of the public in the sea, I'm not aware of the general public being harmed by noise from shipping as such, though in some areas you certainly notice that there's a lot of noise, and it's quite disturbing and it's quite stressful under the water. In terms of workers that are working, it certainly is an issue for them, particularly at depth and noise. And through SAMHSA and through the Department of Labor and Employment, there are certain health regulations regarding divers and underwater workers and noise and those issues. So you can be assured that the attention has been paid to that in school. And then to answer the last member, ma'am, the gap in legislation, it's definitely around the noise. We, in the other elements of my presentation, I was asking for adjustment of some of the things that are already in the bill, i.e. the dropping from 400 tons down to 100 and such like. But we definitely see it as a gap in terms of this noise. And for the reasons I pointed out in the presentation, I think there's a really good opportunity for South Africa to be part of the leading wave of dealing with noise and its impact both on the environmental health and human health is connected with economic health around it, and recognizing that it isn't incremental. The bill sets out an incremental process, and it can be effectively brought in as an incremental process too. Thank you. I hope I've answered the members' questions.
I'm sure you have, Mr. Griffiths, to the best of your ability. Unless you've got a parting shot before we move on from your presentation, I'll give you that opportunity. Maybe let me, I'm fair to my legal people. I suggested that if they want to say something, normally they don't at this stage, but I didn't want to be, on a Tuesday, to be so hard on them.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members and colleagues. Chair, maybe just a point of clarity from the side of the department. Maybe we'll come across it if you are spoiling the part. Chair, some of the commentary, you will see that it talks about amending the annexes, whereas the bill seeks to amend the principal act in order to give effect to the subject annexes, which is annexes 4 and 6 of the convention. I just want clarity from that, chair, because my understanding is that we are not amending the annexes, but rather we are amending the bill seeks to, amend the principal act, but of course giving effect to the annexes. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. You see, the legal minds always complicate things, Mr. Griffiths. Don't worry, I'll help you out. That will deal with the department. I think yours, whether it amends the annexes or the principal act, you are bringing forward your points and views. And then in our deliberations, we will find a space where we agree with your comments, where would it be best suited. So I could see you are sweating already on your head. How am I going to respond to that? But it's a very valid point, and I will not ask the department to respond now. Later, when we have our own deliberations, we may then engage on that one. Any parting shots? Not that we are chasing you out. You are still more than welcome to sit around, but the opportunity to speak will end now.
Thank you very much, Chair, and to the House for this opportunity to present and possibly some new and different things that you've heard today. WESA does recognise that while some of our comments relate to tweaks to what's already proposed, that our noise proposal would be a whole new section in, and we believe this is a really good point, because this legislation is going to go through its further processes through Parliament. It's going to be set, it's going to have an impact over a certain time period, probably over 5 to 10 years, in terms of, if you're looking at some of the proposals in terms of the incremental nature. So it's giving that 5 years. So we're looking at an impact of 10 years. And we really believe that it's an opportune to get in some of these things now, because we're seeing the really deleterious impact that noise, for instance, is having right now. And if it's only 10 years out before we start the next round of white-green papers and white papers and bills, we'll have really lost the opportunity to curtail some of the damage that's being done. And as a question around, there's a trajectory already that's happening in terms of the IMO, which has quite a big leaning on this legislation, that's moving in that direction. And I think instead of being 10 years behind, we have an opportunity to catch up and actually be some of the forerunners. And if you look at how the port is growing, how in terms of Operation Pakisa is trying to forward the growth of our blue economy, I think it's a really great space. Even though I know it means, and somebody's been involved in writing legislation things, I know, so wait a minute, now we've got to go back and start again a little bit. But sometimes it's better to take a step back in order to take 2 steps forward. So thank you very much for the opportunity. You do have my contact details. If any of the members would like to privately engage with me for further clarity around it, WESA and myself are most certainly willing to do so to the best of our abilities. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Griffiths, again for your time and efforts. It means you really take keen interest in the space that you are in. We really thank you. As I said, you are more than welcome to stay on. Just slight housekeeping issue, colleagues. Those who are on my left, there is a door right there behind Mr. Griffiths where you do want to step out and in, so that we try and minimize interruption with our streaming at any time. So we go straight. We are slightly behind, but I think we don't want to rush over these things just because we are looking at the clock. But we do also want to be conscious of the time. We'll go straight to SACOP, Southern Africa Foundation for the Conservation of Coastal Bird. Ms. Monica Sterson, I've already welcomed you, and if you are ready, we want to let you immediately go into it.
Perfect. Thank you so much, and morning everyone, Honourable Chair and committee members. It's really great to be here. I'm just going to share my screen because I do have a short presentation. So it was actually really fitting that I went now after my colleagues from WESA, because a lot of what has been covered in their presentation will be reiterated by SANCOP. So if I do jump over some sections, it's just because it was very eloquently covered by my colleague. Cool. So my name is Monica Stassen. I am the Preparedness and Response Manager at SANCOP. My background is in conservation. I worked primarily with marine mammals, so whales and dolphins, before spending 7 years in fisheries conservation, and then now moving into seabird conservation. So I have, most of my focus has been conservation. It's not moving there, I don't know why. Cool. So just a brief introduction to what SANCOP is and what SANCOP does. But before we really delve into that, I just want to highlight the reason that SANCOP exists, and that is for the conservation of seabird species. And these are our most critical seabird species, our most endemic seabird species, which means they are not found anywhere else in the world other than Southern Africa. So that would be South Africa, Namibia, maybe a little bit in Angola, and that is specific to the Benguela ecosystem. All five of these species, or four out of the five, are considered endangered with declining populations, which means that we are seeing a very concerning trend where they are on the trajectory of being upgraded to critically endangered and possibly extinct in the future. And what's even more concerning for me is that some of these species could be functionally extinct in my time, so while I'm still alive. So what is SANCOP? SANCOP is a registered nonprofit organization whose primary objective is to reverse the decline of seabird populations through the rescue, rehabilitation, and release of ill, injured, abandoned, and oil seabirds, especially endangered species like the African penguin. So SANCOP has been in existence since for many, many years. So this is, SANCOP currently has two rehabilitation centers, one here in Cape Town in Tableview and one in Gqeberha. These centers are uniquely positioned in that they are really close to key seabird colonies and areas, so we are able to rescue seabirds very timely, very quickly. SANCOP has been in Cape Town since the early 1960s and took over the center in Gqeberha in 2018. Both of these centers are open to visitors from the public, so if anyone's ever interested in actually having a tour of our facility, you're more than welcome to come and see what we do and see our operations at hand. So just a little bit about the work that we do, going into a bit more detail. As I mentioned, Sancorp rescues, rehabilitates, and releases endangered species. We also are leading the chick bolstering project. So basically what that is we rescue eggs of African penguins, and we hatch them, and we feed them until they are old enough to be released back into the wild. So we approximately are between 300 and 400 African penguin chicks are hatched from eggs, possibly higher every year. These are eggs that were rescued in the wild that had been abandoned by their parents. We also rescue chicks. In fact, we currently have nearly over 350 African penguin chicks at our center in Cape Town, which were abandoned by their parents. So we're hand-rearing them. We also manage a network of first responders. So these are people that volunteer their time, so they're not paid, to help assist with rescuing of any injured seabirds. We have a network all the way up our west coast. We have a network all the way down along our south coast. And these people are given training in how to stabilize a bird, how to treat, so sort of basic treatment of a bird. And they can look after a seabird for a period of a day or two while we arrange transportation to the center. We are very involved in research, so a lot of work around disease surveillance. A lot of our earlier work was very key in identifying and detecting the outbreak of avian influenza that we had last year, where nearly 20% of our cormorant population was wiped out by the disease. For those that aren't sure of avian influenza, there were a lot of media reports about thousands of dead birds dropping on beaches and on islands. That was due to avian influenza. There is no cure for it. It is fatal. And then we do a lot of monitoring around population and foraging. So where do seabirds go when they eat? Where do they move? And how best can we implement measures or lobby for the implementation of measures to protect them? We work a lot with the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment, as well as Sanparks and Cape Nature in the colonies, providing African penguin and seabird rangers. So these are individuals that have been appointed and are paid by Sancorp to monitor African penguins and to help rescue seabirds. So they don't do any compliance. That's not their mandate. Their mandate is to rescue and to do research on African penguins. We like to appoint individuals from the community in the area as well. We do a lot of training, so we assist with training of rangers and monitoring. Then we have an education component, so we do a lot of outreach. We have schools that come visit our premises, and we also do go out to schools as well, providing exercises on the impact of plastics, of fishing and things, and how it influences seabirds. And then my division, preparedness and response, Sancorp is legally mandated to respond to oil spills that affect wildlife. We are listed in the National Oil Spill Contingency Plan. And so a huge portion of my work is making sure that we as Sancorp are ready to respond to an oil spill when it happens. We also work very closely with a lot of industry to champion the development of wildlife contingency plans. Although not a legal mandate, it is best practice, and the more prepared one is, the less likely your impact will be as severe. So you try and reduce the impact or prevent the impact if possible. And then we do a lot of policy development and a lot of advocacy work around certain high-risk practices such as ship-to-ship fuel transfers at sea and also offshore drilling and oil and gas. And then lastly, advocacy and government. So we also work a lot on lobbying around fisheries management, and I already touched on all the wildlife preparedness. So this is a snapshot of the work that we do. Just so that people can see it in pictures, on the left you'll see there's a little African penguin chick. We've got an African penguin with an x-ray there of a broken leg that we successfully repaired. So we have a fully-fledged seabird hospital in Cape Town that can conduct surgery on affected animals. You can see we've got a pelican at the bottom that's having a swim, trying to repair a broken leg. And then just in the top right-hand corner, that is the map showing the avian influenza outbreak. I don't even have the one of this year. So we're currently dealing with another outbreak of avian influenza, particularly in African penguins, which is really unfortunate. And then the bottom figure is just to name where our seabird and penguin rangers are based. We have a ranger on permanently based on Robben Island. We have four rangers based in Simonstown, one in Stony Point. There is a ranger on Bird Island, and we're hoping to get an additional one on Bird Island in Algoa Bay. And then future plans include a ranger on Dustin Island and at West Coast National Park. So why are we concerned? So these are some of the biggest threats that are facing our seabirds. Lack of food, specifically energy-rich food shortages, oil pollution, disease, oil and gas exploration, mining activities, major vessel grounding, so collisions or things like that, and vessel refueling spills. So as everyone knows, food sustainability encompasses three things: environment, economics, and social. And there's that nice sweet spot where you find a good balance between all three. So Zaka, we're not saying pick one over the other. We're just asking that all three are taken into consideration when things are put together. So SANCOP has responded to every single oil spill affecting seabirds since 1968. So I know it's a very small writing. I couldn't fit everything on one page. But I did map it out nicely for you, but I just wanted you to note that, you know, South Africa, if you look at number 14 in 2000, the Treasure Oil Spill, which is an infamous one, it is the biggest wildlife response, one of the biggest wildlife responses in the world, where nearly over 45% of the African penguin population was oiled. It was also one of the most successful responses, in that 19,000 penguins were successfully washed, rehabbed, and released, so it was over a 90% success rate, and a further 19,000 were actually moved to Cape Receif, released, and then they swam back. African penguins have very high site fidelity, which means they will return to their colony where they breed, and so they took about 10 days to return, which gave them enough time to clean up the oil on the island. But it was a huge impact, and even, you know, sort of almost 20 years later, we have found that those that were successfully released did suffer secondary effects, such as reduced breeding success and things like that. So even though we can help them, there is an effect. And another thing to note is African penguins are quite unique in that they tolerate rehabilitation and being in captivity quite well. Many other seabird species don't. And often in an oil spill, the mortality is extremely high, and a lot of seabirds will die. So this is just a map of, this is a map of all the oil spills, just so everyone can see it mapped out. As you would see, the stretch sort of from Saldanha Bay down to Cape Point is probably our biggest culprit for oil spills. Bulk of them were ship-related collisions or incidents, sinkings, and things like that. And then a new hotspot developing in Algoa Bay, points 19 to 20, and that is all due to ship-to-ship fuel transfers and bunkering. So just diving into the comments, I'll start off with the good news. I don't know why it's cut off on the screen there. SANCOP would like to, likewise, so would like to welcome the amendments. We do feel it's a very significant step in marine pollution. We do want to just flag something for noting. We are well aware that many government departments are undercapacitated, finances are tight, and there are a lot of actions in this bill that need to be implemented. There's a lot of committees that need to be formed, a lot of working groups, and a lot to do. And our concern is that it's going to become a bill that's going to go through, and it's not really going to be implemented as successfully because of capacity constraints. So we just, you know, our question is there going to be additional capacity that is brought in, or are there plans to address this lack of capacity? I know many people have there's many challenges around that, so just to note that. And then moving on to just another comment, amendment section 3A, we really welcome the increase in fine and imprisonment threshold. The previous ones felt very, like someone mentioned earlier, it was most offenders would just pay and move on. Didn't really hurt. So we feel that these new ones are a lot more severe and a much more of a deterrent than a small little slap on the wrist that people easily pay. So going on to our actual concerns and slash comments, there was that insertion in Section 3B in Act 2 that said appoint an advisory committee to advise him or her in the regard. Our main point is we welcome as all the inclusion because it speaks to potentially the capacity concerns. Our only comment and suggestion and is that this advisory committee has a clear terms of reference to follow, has balanced representation, and then that individuals are appointed based on their expertise on the matter. I've participated in several advisory committees in the past, and I've found that if it's not very clearly spelled out in the beginning, you don't actually get the right people in the committee. Then just, this has been touched on already, but sewage here, I found the definition of sewage did not really consider waste generated from the cleaning of engines, equipment, or ships. I'm not sure if this is covered somewhere else in the Act. If it is, then great, but we do feel that that needs to be accounted for because chronic oil pollution is a problem in South Africa, and a huge number of the birds that we do actually get covered in oil are not because of an oil spill, but linked to oil pollution. So it's either through dumping or through cleaning of engines or things like that, that those birds are oiled. And then again, this is already covered, but we were wondering why the focus was only on those ships and why it did not include other vessels sort of in our EEZ in a more broader sense of the word. Then I pulled these two on the same slide because they're more or less the comment that we made very similar. But it is again speaking to making sure that the people that are selected that there is criteria that is used to select surveyors, that people that are selected are independent and not biased. And this speaks to another point that was made about how do you know where these people aren't going to be bribed, aren't corrupt in any way. No system is perfect, and where there's a will, there's a way. But if you have criteria defined, if you have the selection process and things like that, you can reduce the risk of that happening and minimizing the effect that it can have, and then allowing for it to be detected earlier on as well. Then there was this point that was raised. It's very lag in my slides, I see. So shall in due course notify the administration. Our recommendation is that a time frame be put in that because it is extremely vague at the moment, and in due course could mean one day for me, it could mean 5 days for someone else, or 3 months. And it'll be very difficult to hold people accountable or to address a concern or an issue if you only get a report 6 months later. So our suggestion is to look at defining that time frame. It doesn't necessarily have to be like one day, but just a little bit more specific. This comment that was here, and again, it was just looking for clarity. The provisions of paragraph 1 shall not apply to ships operating in water under the jurisdiction of the state. And this could just be because I don't have a legal background, so I might be confusing myself with the legal terminology here, but we just had some clarity on what this actually meant. And then reception facilities, so this came through quite often, making sure that there are facilities at ports and terminals for the reception of sewage without causing delays to ships. And this again has been mentioned that we do have a sewage problem in South Africa, and our main comment was how will this be done to properly when we currently are struggling to manage our own sewage. And I do think, and I don't expect answers to this today, just want it flagged and kept at the back of people's minds that when you do deliberate, these things are considered because, again, otherwise you end up with a bill that's there but it's not being delivered on. And then this is, I think, my last or second last comment. Emissions directly arising from the exploitation, association, and associated offshore processing of seabed materials are exempt from the provisions of this annex. And so my comment was, is this addressed elsewhere by another act? And it is a form of marine pollution and will need to be regulated, especially as we're seeing a huge amount of interest around oil and gas, and a lot more oil and gas exploration taking place. And we know, looking at global statistics around the world, that oil and gas explorations do contribute hugely to emissions. And well, both the actual process of extracting it and then obviously using it later on. Moving on, this is already touched on as well. In case of ships of less than 400 gross tonnage, the administration may establish appropriate measures in order to ensure the applicable provisions are complied with. So again, we recommend that any measures are decided upfront and included in the Act instead of at a later stage. This will avoid confusion and avoid unnecessary delays in the implementation of such measures. And then, shall report at the earliest opportunity to administration. Similar to my earlier comments, a time frame is advisable. You'll find people will more inclined to report things just as they're about to leave, or the latest possible moment when little can be done to address it. There are very few, but some people will. They will be honest and upfront, but from my experience, that's few and far between. And then there was just a comment here, again, this could just be because I'm unfamiliar with legal language. There was a reference to calendar year 2019, and ships of 5,000 tons above shall collect the data specified in appendix to this annex. So our main question was, are these vessels actually collecting the information at the moment? Are they aware that they should be collecting, or is this only dealt with once this amendment is official? So yeah, that is me. So yeah, thank you for the opportunity, and just like to echo again that we strongly support all the comments that Vesta made, and specifically the focus around noise pollution. It is something that we also support strongly, and think it would be really phenomenal for South Africa to get on board with. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tyson. Kort en bondig, straight to the point. Colleagues, there it is. Again, same approach, same procedure. I see Honorable Hunsinga. Anybody else? Honorable Shabangu. I want to twist it the other way around, but it looks like I can't. Please go ahead. go for it.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Mrs. Stassen. For your presentation, first and foremost, allow me to...
Sorry. You see, that's what he always does to me. He changes the way I pronounce it to show that I pronounced it wrong.
which
one is the correct pronunciation? Is it Stassen or Stassen?
Stassen.
All right. Thank you, Cody. Ms. Stassen. Thank you for the correction.
When we get to Xhosa and Zulu, it's quite the opposite. Thank you very much for your presentation and submission, and allow me to thank you for the great work that your organization does. Chairperson, Suncorp is one of our beneficiaries in a community fundraising, which might be interpreted as a conflict of interest if I proceed with questions. But we are particularly grateful to hear in your submission that we're also looking at a ranger at Dawson Island that would be welcomed. To get to your questions, you emphasized a very important point about pollution that shouldn't just be interpreted as something having to do with waste and with spillage, but you also emphasized in the one slide under bullet points activities, particularly mining activities and bunkering activities, which introduces another perspective of what we should consider. Can you expand a bit on that to in particular emphasize the other perspective that we should hold in considering content for this legislation? Under Section 38, you expressed an anticipated fear around capacity, and this is about committees and monitoring functions, and the fear of shortfall in capacity. Are you making this remark from a particular current experience? Could you then give us some examples of current experiences that we should avoid in the design of this future legislation or improved legislation? Then you asked a couple of questions which Chairperson, I think, would be difficult for the department then to give you clarity on, but let me give you the assurance that those questions are noted, and in the process we'll certainly make sure of that, particularly the ones around time frames, which I think is really important, deadlines, in order to establish a effective and efficient measuring and evaluation system and reporting system, so that we don't find ourselves in a dilemma, but that we can rather avoid this. So thanks again. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Shabahu.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for your submission. It was an eye-opener to some of us. You can see I'm feeling better now. Because I'm talking to a lady. I've seen the beds this morning, lady, drinking and diving and eating at a very dirty river that has been dirtified by human beings. How do you intend extending your helping hand to this species not to die because of human error by helping to clean the rivers, especially those found in the middle of the city of Cape Town, because they look bad in the eyes of the tourists? That's my simple question. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Nobody else? Ms. Dawson, you may respond to those that you can respond to. Remember, again, this is your opportunity to give us input. We will consider those. So some things might be things that you might not want to, but the opportunity is yours.
Thank you so much. And again, I appreciate the questions. I'll do my best to answer them as much as I can and be as clear as I can. So my comment earlier on about some of the other activities is that the marine environment is a very holistic space. There are a lot of activities. It is not just used for one purpose or one function, and many of these activities generate waste. And, you know, unlike land where you can put a bin out or you can put a barrier up and contain the waste, once it's in the ocean, it has an effect on everything, from the creatures that live at the bottom to the creatures that float at the top. So it needs to be looked at as a holistic picture, encompassing a range of activities and functions, not just one aspect. Now, shipping does generate a lot of waste, and we know that it has been the culprit for huge volumes of waste that we have, but there are industries that are up and coming that are of concern, and I touched on it briefly, but a huge concern for Sancorp is the practice of ship-to-ship bunkering and fuel transfers in Algoa Bay. It is currently the only port, but there are other ports that are looking at doing that. I believe Mossel Bay, even Saldanha Bay, and a few others. And we've just seen, since 2016, there have been 4 oil spills. And so our concern is that if that practice is extended to other areas and the right legislation is not in place, there will be more oil spills. And as I briefly alluded to, we can respond and we can help seabirds, but the consequences are severe. Many of those seabirds will not survive. Many of them do die, and the long-term effect on their ability to reproduce is hampered. So this is, again, a really unique opportunity, as mentioned earlier, for the bill to encompass and include some of these broader topics like offshore oil and gas exploration activities, ship-to-ship bunkering, and even, you know, the noise pollution, and really be a global leader in addressing some of these issues and some of these concerns. Offshore oil and gas is not unknown. It's common all over the world. It is emerging in South Africa, but it is not without risk. You just have to Google Deepwater Horizon, and you'll come across the biggest environmental disaster that ever hit the world, and the consequences which are still being felt 10 years later. The system in the Gulf of Mexico was changed probably indefinitely, with millions of species dying and plant life affected, and effects of which they're still actually trying to figure out today. So I think that was why I asked if it's not covered, that it should then be included, because I realize it's opening a bit of a can of worms, and it might be difficult to cover everything, but I'm sure that there's legal wording and framing that can be done to cover some of the critical ones, or even the most risky ones. And the other thing with oil and gas is these are platforms that are often put up there, and like, I don't know the extent of monitoring in other countries, but I have, you know, seen and heard and even read papers where they have been found guilty of dumping waste at sea as well. And there's not very many people there to monitor what's thrown overboard on a rig, always. And it could be just, and often it is human waste because it's also offshore, so it's less visible. Moving on to some of the capacity concerns. So some of it comes from my own experience. As I mentioned, I have a background in fisheries conservation, and so I worked very closely for many years with the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment. And a lot of the time when we would put recommendations forward for changes or introduction of new things, we would get told there's just no capacity to do it now. We are aware of it, but there's no capacity to do it now. And specifically around compliance and enforcement was a huge concern and a huge problem that it was severely lacking. And I have heard that similar things from some of the other departments as well, the Department of Transport and even one or two individuals through SAMHSA as well, and DMPA just acknowledged that for certain types of work and certain scopes of work, there are limited capacity. So it's not an impossible solution to overcome. I think the Act already alludes to some solutions, such as appointing surveyors and having advisory committees and external support mechanisms to try and tackle some of those things. So it's, I believe, already on its way. I think it's just to keep in mind that any other functions that could potentially involve broader stakeholder collaboration, the formation of committees or appointment of advisors, be looked at. I do realize that often comes at a bit more of a cost, and there's a bit more of a process for government to go through, and they have to appoint individuals and things like that. But it is just really something I wanted people to keep in mind when you deliberate and look at bringing these things in place, that you look at what is currently, what capacity is there currently, and what would be needed. Sort of a needs analysis. It's something that most companies try and do. We don't want to get it right, and should be done. And I mean, I'm also speaking from an experience as a conservationist. I work for an NPO. We fundraise. Everything comes through funding, and we are almost all the time understaffed. We could always do it with more people. We just don't have enough to get to everything. But we try our best, and we figure out ways to tackle the things that we need to tackle. And then the last question was around the cleaning of rivers and stuff like that. So SANCOP, we do participate in, so recently we participate as part of a memorandum of understanding that we have with Robben Island Museum. We conduct every few weeks a beach cleanup on Robben Island, and we were part of the International Beach Cleanup Day that was just held now in September. We are doing a lot of work around and looking at partnering with a lot of organizations around monitoring on what sort of waste is being collected at different in different areas on beaches and in rivers. Rivers are not our direct line of focus because we work largely with coastal seabirds, but we do collaborate with other organizations, and we do participate in research projects, and we do a lot of advocacy. So part of our education project is about recycling and spreading awareness and encouraging members of the public to participate in beach cleanups, river cleanups, to support organizations to reduce their consumption and usage of plastics, and to be very conscientious of what they do with their plastics and where they dispose of it. You know, just on the drive here this morning, I lost track of the number of people I watched throw something plastic out of the car window on their drive. They don't want it in their car. So there's a lot that we do from just really engaging with members of the public to try and then when initiatives do come, if any of our partner organizations have an initiative that they would like us to champion, like us to share, like us to support, we do engage in that as well and work with them as well. So, yeah, I hope that addresses the question. Thank you.
Certainly does, and we also do note that from my colleague there is no conflict of interest. But thank you so much. If you have any parting shots, that's the opportunity to do so. But I think, again, as I said, this is an opportunity to hear you clarify issues that you have already presented yourself in writing. We engage with them. The department will say less because they'll have an opportunity later to come to the committee and give their comments on your comments. But at the end of the day, it is the committee's process now, and it is the committee's responsibility to effect or not effect whatever would have come in. Again, I want to emphasize there is no input that we do not take seriously at all. So if there are any parting comments, thoughts, I would like to give you that opportunity.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think just to reiterate that we're at SANCOP are very grateful for the opportunity to engage, and we are very pleased that we are given this opportunity to engage right at the start. It is much, much more efficient and effective to be part of something from the start than to try and find a solution once it's already in law. And so this is a really unique opportunity. We think that there's a lot of potential in this amendment. There's really some very positive steps that have been taken to meet not only international obligations, but I think to really address some concerns around pollution. And so, yeah, we're very happy with the direction this is going, and a lot of our suggestions are aimed at just improving the overall outcome of the bill, hopefully make your lives a little bit easier when it comes to enacting the bill, and making sure that, you know, there's a collaboration of going forward. You know, we're very proud and happy to work alongside various organizations, and that includes government. And so this has been a really good opportunity, and we hope to continue engaging. And, my contact information, our contact information is on the submission that we made. And if anyone has any more comments or questions, then I want to find us, and also you know where our centres are. So as I mentioned earlier, anyone is more than welcome to come and see exactly what we do there. Thank you.
Thank you very much again, Ms. Dawson. We appreciate the time, the effort to come and engage with the committee. We are going right along. Our next guest is situated at a very, very far distance, Dr. Ribello, joining us from London. Good morning, Dr. Ribello.
Good morning, Honorable Chair. I'm just
going to
share some slides, if that's okay.
We just want to pass some pleasantries first.
Okay.
Before you go into, did you see the king?
No, I have not seen the king, and I was not there at the Queen's funeral, but the whole of London was ablaze with the festivities, so I couldn't help but feel the impact of them.
Okay. We would like to see your face so that we know we are not speaking to a robot, you know? And thereafter, you are more than welcome to remove it as you do your presentation. But do go and see the king and pass our warm wishes from this committee. So you are most welcome. I'm just concerned your accent is becoming British already, although you are South African. I hope we could get you back quickly. Yeah. All right, Doctor. Yes, on a serious note, if we could just see your face and see who we are talking to, and then
my camera is on, I believe.
Okay. All right. Oh, if that's our setup here, where we are sitting, no, I think it's okay. Maybe they'll find a way. You are welcome, Doctor. You've been following the proceedings, and I'm sure you have seen our approach. So with no further delay, I give over to you.
Thank you. I've got a bit of an issue with sharing slides. I don't seem to be able to share them as a slideshow. I'm not quite sure what's going on. Can you see the very first slide? You can see the margins around it. Is that correct?
Yes, we see it that way. But it's not in slide mode, as you say.
Yeah.
I don't know if our colleagues here can...
Is that better?
That's better. Yes. Now it's on slide mode. Please go ahead.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chair, for this wonderful opportunity to present and to really exercise my civic duty in participating in this opportunity to really engage with this bill and have a look at it and scrutinize it quite carefully. Just to introduce myself, my name is Dr. Pierre Ribello. I am situated at the City Law School at City University of London, and much of my work, including my PhD, has been around international green shipping. So it's an area I'm quite passionate about, and although I don't purport to be any sort of expert in South African local domestic law, and I'm sure there's far more qualified and experienced people when it comes to the National Environmental Management Act within Southern Africa, I am quite familiar with MARPOL and its international impact and its value as an international instrument. So just to begin with, I am very much in support of this amendment bill. I think it is definitely a step in the right direction. But on reading of the Act, the purpose of this legislation in its entirety being the Marine Pollution Prevention of Pollution from Ships Amendment Bill, it really is premised on the idea of giving effect to the MARPOL Convention. So the purposes of this Act is to really fulfill South Africa's international law obligation to enforce MARPOL and its annexes. So I was listening very carefully to the presentations of the colleagues from both WESA and SANCOB who made incredible presentations that flagged and highlighted really important issues when it comes to noise pollution, and when it comes to other areas of pollution. The only problem I foresee with those suggestions to introduce noise pollution in this particular bill would be that the purpose of this bill is to give effect to certain annexes of the MARPOL Convention, and the MARPOL Convention doesn't yet deal with noise pollution. So it might be seen as kind of an act of some sort of unilateral action to introduce it into this particular piece of legislation, but that is not to say that South Africa can't, you know, implement its own laws within its own domestic waters in addition to this piece of legislation. So there's nothing stopping South Africa in any event from making regulations pertaining to noise pollution, which are much needed because as my colleague from WESA has so carefully put together for us just some of the devastating impacts of what noise pollution contains. In terms of the content of what I'll be speaking about today, let me just move slides. There we go. I'll be talking about why I think this particular bill is a step in the right direction, how it is aligned with South Africa's national maritime framework, and also how it's really aligned with some of our decarbonization trajectories within the country. And I'm really focusing on MARPOL Annex 6 because that is really the focus of what my research has been. I'll also be talking about the proposed amendment, so really the amendment to the current legislation that we introduced, an annex that deals specifically with decarbonization and the decarbonization trajectory for the global sector. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the other airborne emissions under the legislation or under the proposed bill, and then some final considerations in terms of implementation. I'm jumping around. Sorry about that. Apologies. So really this bill is a huge step in the right direction. The whole spirit and purpose of what the IMO attempts to do is to create global standards, and this act is also centered very much on that objective. Now, despite South Africa's own challenges to its national energy generation, there's very much a decisive legislative and policy mandate to transition all economic sectors to renewable energy. South Africa has a plethora of policy documents, strategies, as well as bills, such as the climate change bill, that is hopefully going to be passed and enacted. But really, there is a policy landscape which promotes decarbonization. There's also a policy landscape which promotes technology selection and alternative fuel selection. So South Africa is definitely headed in the right direction, and I think that MARPOL, Annex 6, as well as the proposed bill, will definitely contribute to aligning the maritime sector with South Africa's existing decarbonization framework. So this national ambition of South Africa, combined with some strategic objections, provides a promise for achieving just transition. So South Africa is very much committed to this idea of a just transition, and I think that the adoption of this bill will certainly align the maritime sector with that strategic objective. And it will also align maritime policy, which has been a bit slower to uptake this mandate. So maritime policies within the Republic are only really just starting at present time to consider climate change matters and decarbonization. Now, when we look at what the main national maritime policies are in South Africa, we have a comprehensive maritime transport policy, which does provide some statements on climate change and the impacts of maritime transport. We also have the revised white paper on national transport, which shows a clear commitment to reduce the impact of transport on climate change by promoting low-carbon modes of transport in the design of transportation systems. There's also the Green Transport Strategy for South Africa, although this particular strategy notes that maritime transport is quite a small contributor to overall GHG emissions. There's also Operation Paquita, which really talks about the economic benefits of exploiting our position as a maritime nation. South Africa really sits at a key geographical location when it comes to the facilitation of global and economic supply chains. And really, that is something that could be exploited in a way that is very much aligned with the green transition. So exploitation of economic opportunity does not have to necessarily mean that we jeopardize the environment. Very much the premise of sustainable development is that the two coincide. But when it comes to maritime policy, unlike some of the more terrestrial strategies we have, for transitioning South Africa's economy. When it comes to these maritime strategies, there's generally a lack of concrete steps to achieve the aims and the objectives of decarbonization. And this really makes for poor guidance when it comes to channeling investment, for really encouraging international investment in technology selection, and also for maritime actors themselves. So it really kind of, in a way, deters them when they do not have a concrete plan as to how to align themselves with both the policy and the legal objectives of the state administration. When it comes to international maritime policy that South Africa stands to promote and has shown its support for as an active member of the IMO, South Africa has proceeded to ratify or adopted the following conventions. The first one being the Law of the Sea Convention, under which it has a number of duties to protect the marine environment under an international law framework. There's also the MARPOL Convention, which is what we are discussing today, particularly Annex 6, which deals with the decarbonization trajectory for international shipping. Now, the IMO's initial GHG strategy sets the minimum target of reducing emissions by at least 50% by 2050 compared to its 2008 baseline, while generally pursuing a reduction of GHG emissions as a matter of urgency and in consistency with the Paris Accord. So the IMO is very much on a pathway for decarbonization of shipping as a global sector. Now, what MARPOL purports to do and what its focus is global regulation. MARBL is really tasked with providing global standards because industry stakeholders have shown a repeated preference for global standards. And because it is an international convention, that is very much why the legislation before us today and the proposed amendments to the legislation to give effect to these annexes really are not tailor-made to South African context. And that is because it really kind of deals with South Africa's enforcement duty when it comes to implementing a global convention. Now, as I said before, that's not to say other legislation can certainly deal with all of South Africa's particular needs, and certainly the very, very important needs highlighted by WESA and SANCOB, and those things might be more appropriately situated within the National Environmental Management Framework. It would be, I think, a difficult place, not to say that we do not need regulations and standards when it comes to those things, we absolutely do. But this particular act and its amendments that we're discussing today might be a difficult place to situate some of those suggestions, because the IMO hasn't actually created an instrument yet for noise pollution. And although it is hopefully set to do one, until such time as it finds its place into MARPL, and because this act purport is to enforce MARPL, I'm not quite sure how we would do it without particularly showing some sort of additional or unilateral action, which is possible but would not be within the port and scope of this particular act. So just when it comes to the IMO strategy on its reduction for GHG emissions, the IMO is very committed to strengthening and accelerating decarbonization of the global sector. So it's not specific to certain regions or specific states, but it really is looking at ways to implement global standards for a transnational economic activity. Now, the IMO has faced much criticism for this because, by and large, Annex 6 is not a perfect instrument. In fact, the IMO itself has conducted a study which produces evidence to show that the standards we see in this annex will not achieve its own targets. So the standards we see in Annex 6, which we're discussing today to add to existing legislation, they alone will not achieve decarbonization of the sector, which is very worrying. And this has prompted a lot of additional unilateral action by much greater maritime nations, such as the EU region, United States of America, which have implemented their own set of standards for international shipping. Now, the EU can arguably do that because it is a huge regional body with huge state administration capacity in terms of its fleet size and its gross tonnage. So it really is a good place to impose additional and tighter restrictions on shipping access because of that power it has as a regional body. And the EU has taken far more progressive action than the IMO as part of its Fit for 55 decarbonization strategy, which also applies to the maritime sector. But when it comes to the IMO, the forthcoming year is really going to be crucial in terms of our regulatory timeline for what golden standard is set for international shipping as an economic activity. It's going to hopefully set a new ambition level. We're not quite sure what regulatory standards have been agreed on. This annex that we are looking at today, Annex 6, is part of its short-term measures, but next year it is set to announce its mid-term measures, as well as hopefully get to a point where it can decide on long-term measures, as well as capacity and support for the transition. There's been a lot of stalling at the IMO. There's been criticisms that the IMO is subject to corporate capture or subject to the capture of big maritime states and their vested interest in keeping oil running and keeping the whole economic sector of maritime transport dependent on oil. But there's also nuances to that, in that the IMO can really only implement regulations which it knows it is capable of enforcing, and in order to do that, in order to implement these global standards, it needs state support. So the IMO is in a difficult position, and it's hard for it at this moment in time to be overly ambitious when so many of its member states and stakeholders are pushing back against proposals such as having an emissions trading scheme for shipping, which the EU has already taken decisive action on, that is going to include shipping in its EU emissions trading scheme. Now, when it comes to the bill that we are looking at today, really its purpose is to enforce Annex 6. It's also talking about enforcing and giving effect to Annex 4, but my focus really is on decarbonization and Annex 6. And my main concern really is when it comes to giving effect to this particular annex, the bill we have today reflects an old version of the annex. So the bill before us has not really taken into account new technical measures which the Marine Environment Protection Committee adopted quite recently and which will come into force now on the 1st of November 2022. So June of 2021, at the 76th session of the Marine Environmental Protection Committee, they actually strengthened the design efficiency requirements for ships and to a much kind of more stringent technical mechanism than what we see in this present bill. So the present technical measures that are currently in force, because we have not yet come to the 1st of November enforcement date, but the current technical standards are very much reflected in this bill, and that refers to the Energy Efficiency Design Index, which was made applicable to all new ships from 2011, as well as the Ship Energy Efficiency Management Plan for all existing ships. Now, the Energy Efficiency Design Index, also known as the EEDI, is really a performance-based mechanism. So as long as the energy efficiency of the vessel is obtained, the choice of technology is left open and available to maritime actors, shipping companies, charters, to really decide for themselves what mechanism they're going to use to reduce their reliance on fuel and to operate in a more energy efficient manner. Now the Ship Energy Efficient Management Plan applied to all existing ships, and this really involved a plan as to what the long-term trajectory would be for that vessel to achieve decarbonization aims in alignment with what the IMO is hoping to achieve in its vision for decarbonization. So this bill that we have here reflects these standards, but it's important to note that the convention is being updated, Annex 6 is being updated, and new requirements are coming into force, and they will be in effect on the 1st of January 2023. So these new standards are a bit more ambitious than what we see in the present bill. Again, we see the Energy Efficiency Existing Ship Index, the EXI, is really going to replace the EEDI, and this proposes tighter technical standards for energy efficiency. So all ships have to obtain a certain level of energy efficiency in their design, in their specifications, in their engine parameters. They need to achieve a level of energy efficiency to be compliant with the annex. But there's also this introduction of an carbon intensity indicator, which is a very, very useful tool, because what it does is it really ranks the vessels according to their energy performance, their intensity of fuel that they are using, and gives them an annual rating, A to E. The A obviously being the best, E not being so great. And the idea is that ships that are falling in lower categories, so maybe D or E, need to improve upon that. And they need to make, they need to submit plans, as well as included in their ship energy management plan, as to what they are doing about their plans to obtain higher levels of energy efficiency. So these are the short-term measures that the IMO has implemented, and they are very much on track with what the IMO has put itself on a trajectory for. So we are going to probably see perhaps new measures come into place in addition to these, but these are very much what the IMO has decided will apply now from 1st of January 2023. So my main suggestion is really, in order to future-proof this present bill, is to really consider bringing about to introducing these new technical standards so that we are really reflecting the global industry standards and we are not reflecting old technical criteria. So we do have this revised MARPOL NX6, which applies to all ships, Another big amendment here in comparison to what we see in the bill is that the EEXI will apply to far greater ships than what we saw its predecessor, the EEDI, applied to. So hopefully this will align far more vessels with the IMO's decarbonization strategy. And as I said, the regulatory amendments to MARPOL Annex 6, which the IMO has implemented and which I would like to see in the bill, really form part of the short-term measures, although we will see mid-term measures announced in the near future. Although the IMO is stalling, there are talks about an emission trading scheme. How they intend to bring about these new market-based measures that they are suggesting, we do not know. It might need more amendments to its annexes, or it might see the creation of a new instrument which establishes an emission trading scheme for the sector. So that would be my number one suggestion when it comes to this bill, to just update the technical standards so that we do reflect what the rest of the world is doing. Although there might have been some backlash by certain stakeholders and various interests, it is important that we subscribe to the utmost level of care when it comes to the environment. And if there are stricter global standards, to rather implement the stricter standards and to really level the playing field, because industry doesn't like to see a patchwork quilt of various standards and various unilateral actions taken by states. Now, I'm not sure if it is the intention of the department to utilize this particular provision, which I see has been proposed as part of the bill. So you'll see that the bill introduces a Section 2A and a Section 2B, which gives the department the powers to update this legislation going forward, to really align the legislation with amendments that are being made to MARPOL as they are introduced. So that is a possibility to push this bill through and amend it at a later stage. That is an option that, you know, it's really my humble submission that the Department of Transport doesn't see fit. Perhaps there is an urgent mandate to push this bill through and to really honor our international law obligations to enforce MARPOL and its annexes. But there does seem to be some scope here for updating at a later stage. I don't know if that will mean, you know, doing the work twice. But my suggestion is that as soon as possible, we update these technical standards, even in the event that this bill is to be pushed through with old standards, that they are updated quite soon. There are also a number of considerations which really need to be considered when it comes to implementing not only the technical criteria which the IMO has set, but also to show support for the IMO's larger decarbonization plans and trajectories. Because really the spirit and the purpose of this legislation is to support the IMO and to honor our international law obligations to decarbonize the sector. And the IMO, although it is not perfect, although we see that Annex 6 is by no means perfect, that's the best instrument we have thus far, because there is a shared stakeholder preference for uniform standards. Whenever we see unilateral action being taken by states, it creates problems, it creates commercial uncertainty. It's a transnational sector, and therefore global standards are always preferable to really states taking their own sort of forces when it comes to imposing standards on foreign vessels. So we really need to look about how we can future-proof this legislation, and to be specific, I would like to see the technical standards updated to reflect what the global community is doing. I also think when it comes to implementation, there's a lot of kind of enforcement responsibility placed on the state administration in order to issue surveys and EEDI certificates. But this will not prove overly burdensome. Yes, South Africa has a small fleet, and many of these surveys, as regards to the enforcement of Annex 6, can be entrusted to nominated surveyors, and you can essentially pass the cost down to ship owners or charterers. So, you know, the compliance with energy efficiency isn't really a matter and an expense for the ship owner itself. Now, where South Africa will probably have greater enforcement responsibility, not so much as a flag state administration, but more as a port state. because it will have to ensure that vessels coming to South African ports are compliant with these energy efficiency standards. This, I do not think, will detract from the attractiveness of the SA Ship Registry, because all states are really implementing decarbonization strategy, whether they be party to MARPOL or not. And MARPOL has a huge amount of global support. A lot of states have ratified MARPOL and have ratified Annex 6. I've spoken a bit about the port inspection duties. So there might be, South Africa will require some capacity here at its ports for really familiarizing itself with what is required in terms of the energy efficiency requirements, mainly that ships must carry an energy efficiency certificate as well as a CEEMP. I don't foresee that updating the technical standards to reflect the most recent ones in MARPOL Annex 6 will produce any more burdens in terms of port state responsibility than what we currently see that port states would have under the bill that is being proposed today. So really, there are similar reporting requirements that you would see if you were to update these technical standards to reflect the carbon intensity indicators as well as the EEXI in replacement of the EEDI. So the reporting standards for flag state administration will not be overly cumbersome either. It really will be quite similar to what we see in the bill. The flag state in South Africa will have to report to the IMO ship fuel oil consumption database. But as I said, we only have a small fleet of about 106 vessels registered on the SA Ship Registry. I don't see those reporting standards being overly cumbersome, and I might be unaware of the kind of capacity that is already in place to report those standards. Now, Annex 6 also deals with other airborne emissions. It deals with sulfur oxides as well as nitrous oxides and ozone-depleting substances. When it comes to ozone-depleting substances and nitrous oxides, most of those obligations are really kind of the mandate of the ship owner, and the port inspection duties and the state administration duties are not particularly cumbersome. It's more something that the ship owner has to concern himself with, or the company has to concern themselves with. But sulfur content has been quite controversial, and this standard is present in the bill because this was introduced as an amendment to MARPOL Annex 6 a few years ago and came into force on 1st of January 2020. So this standard already applies and it is in the bill, and the updated technical standards that we see do not change what we see in this bill with regards to sulfur content. So already MARPOL Annex 6 prescribes that ships may not use fuel oil with a sulfur content of above 0.5%. So that was quite controversial when it was launched at a global scale, because the industry said, well, how on earth are we going to meet the standard? We are so reliant on heavy fuel oil. We'll never meet the 0.5% requirement. And that was just really not true, okay? There definitely was a lot of opportunity for us to transition the oil sector and to not make maritime transport so reliant on heavy fuel oil. What it also did is it spurred non-fuel oil alternatives, such as switching to liquefied natural gas to propel vessels as opposed to heavy fuel oil. Now, LNG is in of itself not a perfect alternative. Although the sulfur emissions are quite low, its carbon emissions are nothing to worry about. The carbon emissions will definitely not enable the shipping sector to decarbonize. So yes, there's controversy around LNG, and really LNG has been touted as a solution mainly by American interests because of their shale gas boom. So when it comes to complying with the 0.5 sulfur standard, the main compliance method that vessels are using is something called a scrubber, which is an exhaust gas cleaning system. And unfortunately, the IMO accepted scrubbers as an alternative compliance method to meet the 0.5% standard. And what we is that most of the maritime sector has opted to install scrubbers as opposed to sourcing low sulfur fuel. And it really hasn't have the impact on oil supply chains or maritime fuel supply chains that we hoped for, because the majority of vessels are simply just installing these exhaust gas cleaning systems. So it is on this point that I think South Africa or Parliament might want to consider whether it is going to accept scrubbers. Now, it is the complete prerogative of the state to accept alternative methods of compliance. And although Markel approves scrubbers, and South Africa itself has approved scrubbers in maritime notices, it might be a rational point of departure from what the global community is doing. So just to speak about this, South Africa has said that effectively all scrubbers are permitted for entry into South African ports. We see that from Marine Notice Number 8, which gave effect to this new IMO 0.5 sulfur cap regulation. And then we also saw the Marine Notice specifically dealing with scrubbers, which says that at the present time, until further notice, South Africa accepts all types of scrubbers. Now, the problem with these scrubbers is not so much that they've deterred a transformation of fuel sources, which we were hoping to see, but some of the bigger problems arise as to the systems employed on these exhaust cleaning systems. So an open-loop scrubber, unfortunately, will pour its wash water into the ocean. So really what it is doing is, although it is helping us keep the air sulfur-free, it is effectively introducing far more chemicals into the marine environment. So these scrubbers have the capacity to be quite detrimental in our national waters, especially in areas of ecological sensitivity. You also get something called a closed-loop scrubber, whereby maritime operators would need to keep the residues on board. Now, closed-loop scrubbers are far more environmentally friendly, and as such, nation states such as Singapore, parts of the EU, are saying that they are only accepting closed-loop scrubbers. There might be some incentive here to ban scrubbers altogether, and as such, you will not need port reception facilities for the use of scrubbers if you are to ban them. But scrubbers are so dangerous for marine environments, because a lot of scientific research is indicating just how harmful scrubber wash water is. A lot of chemicals are released. I'm not a scientist, so I cannot advise you on all the ins and outs of scrubber wash water. But I do know that the University of Gothenburg has released some data which would suggest that scrubbers are not the solution. Yes, we need to ensure that vessels are not emitting sulfur into the atmosphere, but we also need to ensure that the payoff is not really passed down to our marine environment by distributing or really polluting our oceans with scrubber wash water. Just some final considerations on this particular bill, which aims to implement and give effect to Markel Annex 6. It still remains quite unclear how the IMO energy efficiency standards are going to achieve a sectoral transition. So this annex is by no means a perfect international law instrument, and as such, it probably won't make for perfect domestic legislation, and it's certainly not going to meet all of South Africa's domestic needs, but it is still a step in the right direction, because we need a global standard, and South Africa needs to show support for some sort of a global standard, because this is a transnational sector. Hopefully the IMO will give further guidance, especially when it comes to technology selection, when it comes to what sort of support is available to maritime actors, being, you know, private commercial interests, as to how they are going to receive support for decarbonization, because the cost to ship owners is huge. The cost to ship owners is absolutely massive. At present, the EEDI is not seeing huge ship conversions, because the EEDI is quite a low standard, and it's a standard we know is not going to meet IMO global ambitions, and furthermore, it's not aligned with the Paris Accord. So the current EEDI really just seeing ship owners adjust their engine parameters or to use things such as slow steaming or virtual arrival, which are important tools and important operational measures, but they are not going to achieve a sectoral transition. So we need some further advice, and I do think that the labeling system we see by the carbon intensity indicator that is the NEPC has enforced and will be enforcing from 1st of January 2023 is a much better tool to publicize the performance of vessels and to rate vessels on an A to E scale, because that will also drive this mandate not only from the top down but from the bottom up, where consumers can exercise responsible shipping choices. We also need to really align maritime policies with national climate ambitions. So South Africa has a lot of strong policy and progressive policy in place when it comes to climate ambitions and achieving a just transition, but maritime policies need to catch up. And maritime policies really need to give the maritime sector some indication as to what sort of technology selection will be promoted. Will there be onshore power supply or electric vessels, for example? There's a lot of implementation issues surrounding a decarbonization mandate. What alternative fuels are going to be suggested to support ships within our South African registry to meet decarbonization trajectories? So there's the enactment of this bill is a very important legislative step, but it also needs to be supported by stronger policy strategies. And we need to see a lot more support for research and development. When it comes to sourcing the finances, because this all sounds incredibly expensive, and that's why there's been such backlash by private commercial actors whenever a new environmental regulation is announced, because these are high-risk, high-cost investments. And quite frankly, we do not have a technological solution yet. Ships travel at very long distances. International voyages cover, you know, vast spaces and areas where ships might not always have access to alternative fuels, or they might not be able to rely purely on renewables because the technology is just not there yet. So research and development is needed. But where the money will come from, I think there's huge developments taking place in the areas of green finance at an international scale. So green finance is really the private sector mobilization of funds to not only support R&D, but to support first movers in the industry, to support first movers to uptake greener technologies, to explore alternatives to high fuel oils that release vast carbon emissions, and DR says to even explore alternatives to LNG, because LNG, although it releases far less sulfur, it's not a great alternative to meet our decarbonization targets. There's also the problems around fracking and exploration, which would lead me to conclude that LNG is not a great alternative solution in decarbonizing any sector. So there needs to be some sort of strategy around de-risking innovation and driving market change. Now, there's also been a really, really good report that was commissioned by P4G, and it was compiled by the Getting to Zero Coalition. And I'm sure many members in this room might be aware of this report, but it also spoke about the vast opportunity here that South Africa has for being kind of a front runner of decarbonization efforts for a global maritime sector. And South Africa really, I don't think, has fully utilized its geographical location in terms of global trade, and it really can make a massive impact on a global community. But in order to achieve some of the opportunities outlined in this particular report, a big suggestion and really one of the main recommendations coming out of this report is we need legislation and we need stronger policy. So I think the fact that we are here discussing this bill today is a massive step in the right direction. I'm in huge support of the decarbonization of all economic sectors, and I think the maritime sector on a global scale is lagging behind, and we don't want to see that happen in South Africa. We want maritime transport to catch up and to commit itself to better decarbonization targets, but we also have to be very much aware that it's an international enterprise and we need to implement global standards because of stakeholder preference. And that preference is not just a matter of, oh, we don't want the inconvenience of dealing with different laws and regulations every time we enter into different waters. It is going a lot more to commercial certainty, to channeling investment. There's a number of factors that really, you know, come into play when we talk about global standards for a transnational sector and why global standards are so preferable to a patchwork quilt of different ideas and different unilateral action. Big regional bodies, of course, they have the capacity as well as the regional power to implement unilateral action. But I think South Africa has already shown a big commitment here to decarbonizing the maritime sector by implementing this bill. As I say, my main proposal is that we keep up to date of technical standards and we reflect the most recent technical standards that the global community is adhering to. And then very quickly, my other suggestion was to perhaps consider whether Parliament will permit scrubbers as an alternative. It already does, but perhaps this bill is an opportunity to say that scrubbers should not be an alternative to low sulfur fuels. So that's where I will leave it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Doctor. We appreciate your input. I'll go straight to colleagues if they have comments, questions. Honourable Hunsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Dr. Rebello. Good morning on your side. We're closing in on afternoon already, but since you've got a 2-hour lead time this side, it's still morning where you are. Thank you very much for your submission and also for giving us some form of vision of how we should approach this, but also sort of keep very important elements in the back of our mind, international progress, progressiveness, sort of leading thinking, leading thoughts in this space. I've also learned this morning that in a week's time on the 15th, of November, we will be hitting the 8 billion mark of inhabitants on Earth, which really also underscores your main point about the balance of economic benefit on the one side, the commercial interest, and environmental protection on the other hand. And I would like you to, if you could, give us a perspective from your side about how this piece of legislation then can also assist in making the South African or this the SA ship registry more attractive. What should our thinking be to then have this balance between environment and economic interest, but in particular attract more interest to our SAE registry, which I think at this stage we've got 5 ships registered, because there is this underlying fear that through regulation, which would be sort of restrictive in a certain way, it could be a deterrent. So on the flip side then, how could we make our registrar a bit more attractive? Thank you, that would be my question. And we certainly take note of your whole presentation around scrubbers and the dangers thereof and the progressive thinking aligned to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Hunsinger. Doctor, that was the only comment I have from my colleagues. I hope it's not a time factor issue. I want to check my legal people here if they don't have any comment or question to ask. Yes, just hold on a little bit, Doctor.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, not for now, Chair.
Thank you. Doctor, you may comment, respond on that comment, please. And as well, just give your parting shots, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Well, in terms of making the South African ship registry more attractive, I don't believe implementing decarbonization regulations and energy efficiency regulations are going to be much of a deterrent, because most states are having to do this. Okay, in fact, we're seeing even stronger states the unilateral action taken by countries like the USA, the EU, they're imposing much heavier burden on their vessels and those vessels registered within their registries. So I don't see this regulation being much of a deterrent. If anything, it really is the bare minimum of what the global community expects as a global standard. In terms of making South Africa's ship registry more attractive, I really think there's probably more policy considerations as to how to support the South African fleet in transitioning. This bill is just one legal tool which needs a lot of support from policy strategy, and it also needs support from the private sector. We seem to think that, you know, decarbonization of the transnational sector is going to come down to governments and the IMO. The reality is it's going to come down to private industry actors. And many of these transnational actors are far more powerful than states in many regards in what they are able to achieve. So we need a lot of policy support as well as private sector support. And I think the main one is going to come down to finance. So making South Africa's ship registry far more attractive, we need to look at, well, what green finance tools are available to really incentivize first users when they are taking up energy efficiency designs and greener technologies. So is the finance there? Is the money there to help our vessels move on this decarbonization trajectory? And that financial question is, can be assisted by governments in creating green finance policies or sustainable finance policies, but really it's going to require a lot of mobilization of private funds as well. What South Africa could probably consider is really more around what it is capable of doing around ports and port enforcement and how it's going to support vessels in ports really make the move away from carbon-heavy fuels. Is there going to be onshore power supply? Where is that onshore power supply going to come through? Are we earmarking certain alternative fuels in our policies? There's already quite a big push for hydrogen as an alternative fuel within South African policy, but very much more at a national terrestrial level than looking at marine fuels. So those are just some of the things we can do to really support our fleet of vessels in transitioning. But really, we also need to think globally, how are we going to support a global sector and what is our role in decarbonizing a massive maritime international transport sector.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Did you have any parting shot you wanted to make before we thank you, or was that it from your side?
I just like to thank you very much for allowing me to make this very humble submission, and I thank you for allowing me to really engage with this bill, and I do believe that it is a step in the right direction, and I'm very proud to see South Africa taking up such legislation and honoring its international law obligations and really making a strong commitment, a tangible and concrete commitment to decarbonization of the maritime sector. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. We appreciate it. Do not forget my request to visit the Queen. Oh, sorry, the King.
I'll keep that in mind.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Much appreciated. All right, colleagues, let's take the last presentation by Ms. Melissa Groening from Natural Justice Presenter. She's been here. And I think her neighbor, Ms. Dawson, could have set a good tone there to say weight has already been mentioned. I jump over it and tackle those issues that are totally fresh. You are most welcome. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you also to the honorable members here and other ladies and gentlemen in the room. To start off, I'd like to say thank you on behalf of Natural Justice for this opportunity to comment on the bill and to be here to present to you. Natural Justice is a Pan-African non-profit organization. We call ourselves lawyers for communities and the environment, and we work with communities across South Africa and across Africa to affirm and defend their rights. We are working with quite a number of coastal communities at the moment, particularly in relation to the offshore oil and gas development and how that may affect their rights. So it is in this context that we are also considering other impacts to the ocean resources, and to those coastal communities' ways of life, and the impacts also to the public at large in South Africa. And I'll get into that a little bit shortly. Just to say, I don't have a presentation for you today, and I hope that's okay, but I also won't be keeping here too long. I will avoid any comments that have already been raised, and I also won't be going through every pointed out submission, but I'll just focus on some key issues that I wish to highlight today. I think the context within which we find ourselves looking and addressing this particular bill was important. And that's one which is really around climate change and resource scarcity. And we know that climate change is having major impacts already. It's not something of the future. It is a crisis that we are currently facing, and it is our poor people and often communities living in rural areas who are most impacted by the climate, those communities which rely on those resources. In this context, those ocean resources are a way of life for many, many communities along the coast, and any impact on these resources affects their ability to live and to thrive. So not only do we have impacts from the oil and gas industry, from the shipping industry, but we, you know, we are facing a global biodiversity crisis, as well as impacts from land-based pollution, many other environmental impacts, and all of these are cumulative in the way that it impacts communities and the public. So I'm going to start with some general comments around the bill, which apply to maybe both annexes or the amendments to the Act itself, and then I will look at a couple of specific issues that I'd like to deal with. So the first one is around penalties and enforcement. And the colleagues in the room today have already mentioned how it's really a fantastic step in the right direction to be increasing from $500,000 to $10 million as the maximum fine. We are, however, concerned that this is not enough to act as a deterrent to those who continue to pollute the ocean. We know that cleanup operations will cost millions and millions of rands, and the impacts can run into the billions. So if we look at, you know, 10 million rand in the scale of what the impacts might be, where there are impacts, and also in relation to our exchange rate, where we've got many of these polluting companies who are not even based in South Africa, and to be honest, 10 million is shortchanged to many of them. So we would like to see a substantial increase in this maximum amount. Alternatively, look at setting minimum penalties and not prescribing a maximum penalty if that would be permitted, and also the consideration of alternative penalties, you know, that might not be associated with a very specific monetary amount. We think it is also necessary to consider continued offences, so instead of a pollution incident which might take place over a number of days or repeatedly, instead of that being one incident subject to one fine or other penalty, that, you know, for every day, for example, that the offence continues, that should be considered a separate offence, and consequently the fines can rack up in that way. We do see this in other jurisdictions around the world. For example, in the Canada Shipping Act, there is a section which holds a person or a vessel accountable for each day that offence continues. In relation to compliance, that has also been, well, enforcement and compliance has been mentioned already by colleagues today, but I would like to just draw attention to the need perhaps for integration with other enforcement officers already existing in the country in relation to our environmental management legislation. We've got a number of specialized skills already within the enforcement sector, and I hope that these will be strengthened in relation to implementing and ensuring compliance of this bill when it is an act. And to ensure that officers and anybody involved in enforcement of this act are specifically trained to do so. We found that, you know, many enforcement officers, you know, in general enforcement, will not understand the intricacies of these types of laws, will not understand the intricacies related to pollution and to impact on the environment. So it's extremely important that, you know, these skills are, that these officers are upskilled in relation to investigation and enforcement. Then on to cooperative governance, we note that the proposed Section 3B empowers the Minister to appoint an advisory committee and to conclude a cooperative agreement with other states. We also note that the memorandum to the bill indicates that the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment has been consulted. However, we don't think that the bill as it stands is strong enough in relation to cooperative governance, particularly in relation to how the Department of Transport will work with the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment, and any other relevant departments, in fact, as well as coastal municipalities. There's extensive overlap between the mandate and governance by the Department of Transport in this Act, as well as the powers and the mandate of the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment in the functional areas of municipal competence, as set out in Section Schedules 4 and 5 of the Constitution. Our concern is that these departments and officials will not work cooperatively in enforcement of their respective extremely overlapping laws, which may lead to wasteful use of resources and governance in silos, and resulting confusion and enforcement. We see the bill as providing a valuable and somewhat unique opportunity for cooperative governance to be ingrained within the Act itself. So we call on Parliament to take that into consideration. Similarly, it is not clear how the provisions of this bill, when it's an Act, will align with the provisions of the other environmental laws, particularly in relation to the Integrated Coastal Management Act, which also regulates incineration or dumping at sea, emergency dumping at sea, and, for example, also the National Environmental Management Act, which deals with emergency incidents, which would also apply out at sea. So, there needs to be some extensive review on how the provisions of these different laws overlap, how the enforcement provisions will work, and how these departments and enforcement officers will cooperate with each other. Then in relation to the procedure in getting this bill to where it is today, we are concerned about a lack of consultation directly with communities, and these communities along the coast will be directly impacted by these pollution or other incidents out at sea. They will be the most impacted, and it appears that there has not yet been any direct consultation or attempt to bring the provisions of this bill to them. We've seen our courts recognize in you know about the Shell case and the Search of Seismic case and various other cases in our courts at the moment, how important consultation is, how important that consultation is meaningful and effective, and it's not just about compliance with minimum requirements of the law. So we do call on this committee and Parliament to take consultation much wider than it traditionally has been done for these types of bills, and to ensure that there is a consultation with potentially affected communities in a manner that can be understood. We do also note, from what we can see in the memorandum, that there are no technical experts which have been consulted, unless those are housed within the departments themselves. But given the very technical nature of a number of the amendment provisions, we recommend that even if it is outsourced, or consultants are brought in to advise on the technical aspects and compliance, and really the practicability of enforcing and implementing these provisions on a technical sense. Then to deal with a couple of the specific provisions in the annexes, so under Annex 4, which is related to prevention of pollution by sewage, we note that Regulation 3 provides for an exemption in emergency circumstances. There is a similar provision in Annex 6 relating to the air pollution from ships. However, we are concerned that there might be an exemption, but there is no other mechanism to deal with where there is pollution, either airborne or sewage pollution, which arises in those emergency circumstances, that the bill and the annexes as they stand do not make provision for dealing with those emergencies. Another aspect which we find in both Annex 4 and 6 is in relation to the certificates which are to be issued. Regulation 7 in Annex 4 refers to them being published in at least English, French or Spanish. However, we call on this committee in Parliament to consider introducing mandatory requirements to publish them or to use other official languages of South Africa, which are more easily understood by our by the public. Under the Annex 6 regulations for the prevention of air pollution from ships, I would also like to bring attention to the exemption application. Well, exemptions in two circumstances. One is for the technology trials, and the other is in relation to exploration, oil and gas exploration and exploitation activities. In relation to technology trials, which is under Regulation 3.2, which makes provision for exemptions from the provisions of the Annex to conduct trials for the development of ship emission reduction and control technologies and engine design programs. Whilst we welcome this kind of research, we are concerned that these are sort of broad-ranging exemptions without much control. There's also no procedure to consider these types of exemption applications, which you know could lead to ad hoc and you know subjective standards being applied to grant those exemptions. You know, just like an atmospheric emission license on land would be subject, even in a test scenario, would be subject to public participation in certain application and assessment requirements, we believe that these exemption applications should be subject to those kinds of requirements, including public participation. Once these approvals have been granted, the approval itself, as well as the conditions, should be made available publicly and in appropriate languages. In relation to the exemption for offshore exploration and exploitation, we recognize that this exemption comes from the MARPOL convention text itself. However, we are concerned that this exemption exists, and we do call on this committee and Parliament to consider mechanisms to cover that gap effectively. We are, as you all know, we are sitting in an extreme climate crisis where these exemptions, where emissions arising from exploration and exploitation and offshore processing of seabed minerals will have significant emission additions to our country's emissions. So, you know, there really is a need to regulate it in some way. So if it is going to be excluded from this particular act, it must be regulated in some other way. We note that this exclusion may well violate Sections 12 and 24 of the Integrated Coastal Management Act, which requires the state, in its capacity as the public trustee of all coastal public property, which includes coastal waters, to ensure that it is used, managed, protected, and conserved and enhanced in the interest of the whole community. The whole community in this context includes humans and animal species, and to take whatever measures need to be taken. Section 21 also sets out that an organ of state that is legally responsible for controlling or managing any activity on or in coastal waters, so that would, in this case, be the Department of Transport, having a control over these kinds of shipping within our coastal waters, must manage and control that activity in the interest of the whole community and in accordance with the Republic's obligations under international law. So this would include our international climate change commitments. So I'd like to end it there, and I do welcome any comments, and I thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Colleagues, there it is. Just maybe to introduce some issues that you raised, others directly in your submission, others subtly in your presentation now. You make mention in your written submission that you would propose or you'd like this bill to be sent to the National House of Traditional Leaders. Can you explain to us why that particular proposal, number one? Number two, you mentioned a couple of times, even now, even in your written submission, that the minister did not consult or the department any local communities. You then become specific to KZN and the Western Cape areas. Maybe can you explain to us how you come to that particular accession? And you also further on today mentioned specifically, I think, the issue of technical experts, suggesting specifically the usage of consultants in this area. And again, I'd like to get some clarity as to why you think that will assist us in any form going forward. Those would be my three and a half comments, questions directly. I don't know if colleagues have got any addition. They are not even looking at me, so it means they are not having any. So please, if you may. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson, for those questions. I'll address the first one around the traditional authorities, and I refer specifically to the memorandum. On the last page, there is an item 6.2, which says the state law advises of the opinion that it's not necessary to refer the bill to the National House of Traditional Leaders, as the bill contains no provisions which directly affect customary law or the customs of traditional or Khoisan communities. And our assertion here is that the impact of this kind of regulation and the activities that it seeks to regulate do have an impact on Indigenous communities, specifically those that are situated along the coast. And it's for that reason that it is recommended that it does move through the National House of Traditional Leaders. On the second point, the consultation with communities, I'll just refer to exactly what we said in our submission here. Okay, we said that the minister did not consult any local communities, including South Durban communities and Western Coast communities. And that comes also to what I've referred to, and simply what we see in the document in the memorandum before us, and what we have seen in the public domain is that there has not been any direct consultation. We submit that the mechanism of consultation via a public, the national publication of a bill for comment is not sufficient to enable participation by communities. They would need direct consultation to understand what this is about, what is being proposed, and how it affects them. I've referred already to how it may affect any impacts in the ocean directly affect not only their livelihoods, but also their cultural and spiritual practices, which are constitutionally protected, and our courts have also recently recognized that protection. So I hope that answers your question around the communities. Of course, if there has been direct consultation and simply not in the documents before us, then it would be great to understand what that consultation has been already. Then on the technical experts, I think it's been really wonderful to hear from the scientific experts here today. We've heard from lawyers working in this space, and perhaps there are technical experts within this room, but in relation to, for example, air quality, and also Dr. Ribello has already referred to, for example, the use of scrubbers and how ineffective those are, and that's just one example of why technical experts should be consulted so they can understand, what are the impacts of what is currently happening in relation to these emissions from ships, what is proposed under these annexes from a technical perspective, what is practical, what can actually be done to achieve what the bill sets out to do.
All right. Thank you very much. I don't know if my colleagues have received some inspiration to comment. I don't want to engage on the issue of technical aspects because it might derail us from what we want to achieve. Because just to say, to have a bill to be produced to the level that is at, it is at on its own for me is a clear indication that there is technical expertise or knowledge sitting somewhere, whether it's in the department or anywhere, but you don't just wake up and produce a bill of this quality that everybody seems to be commending without any technical expertise, you know, because, yes, I think let's leave it there, but I think your response really suffices as to your views as it relates to this particular aspect. On the issue of public participation and your views as to what you think would be sufficient from the department, I think we take note of those comments. And as this already now has left the domain of the minister and the department, it's now in our hands as a committee. Today we have seen everybody who has shown interests, keen interests in this particular piece of legislation. So as we deliberate as a committee, we will then obviously take your comments into consideration as to do we feel as a committee that given your comments and our observations, has there been sufficient or particular in this regard. So rest assured that the committee will apply its mind, and if the committee so feels that there is a need for further consultation and maybe specific targeted consultation in certain affected areas, it's something that we will certainly consider. That's the assurance I want to give you. Although it's a subject that when is sufficient consultation sufficient? It's something that can be very subjective. But I think in your instance, you are specific in areas which I think in your way, in your working with these people, you are sure that in those areas there is keen interest. However, they might have been limited by one thing or the other not to be able to consult, and we take that point and we take it seriously as such. So, yes, again, I want to take the opportunity to thank you and your organization for the interest in this and all the propositions and proposals you've made. Like everybody else I've done, or I've given them an opportunity, I want to give you a parting shot opportunity on this subject. Before, if there is any, before we close your section of the submission.
Thank you, Chief. And I've got no parting shots for you. Thank you for
your You've already parted the shot. But thank you once more. So, colleagues, that really brings us to the end of this session of engaging. It has really been very enlightening, as many of my colleagues have already said so. This is the beauty of public participation or democracy, because none of us sitting here can claim to be experts in the true sense of many pieces of legislation in a portfolio like transport that we deal with. So to have people like yourselves, all of you, speaking so passionately, knowledgeably, and you can see that you have taken the time to go through this legislation before you came to make your presentation, it's truly appreciated. And again, as I said earlier, that we take public participation and your comments, and I'm repeating it because we have heard in any instances where people ask, what will the purpose of my input make? And I can say specifically for this committee that we do take every input of yourselves, because you are confronted with these issues every day. Me next week I'll be dealing with rail issues. The other week I'll be dealing with taxi issues. But with you, it's something you deal with every day. So your inputs become very, very valuable. Open our eyes. They show us the blind spots that we could have missed along the way. And with that, I really want to say we truly, truly appreciate that, and we'll consider everything you have submitted. Typically, as somebody said, there is a process that we undertake. The department is here because this bill has been introduced by the executive, being the minister. We give them an opportunity to go back and consider what has been presented and give their comments, and specifically their comments. It's not their process now, but we give them an opportunity also, because they must also comment that here we agree, here we don't, but it doesn't mean we will take everything they say. We apply our own mind. Where we think we need more information, we'll engage with yourselves to say, clarify here. And at the end of the day, we make that determination as to do we think has been sufficient public participation in this area. Obviously, pieces of legislation and interest differ from area to area. But as I said, the last presenter was specific in raising that issue. And again, at the risk of repeating myself, we will certainly consider that. And then we will take it through our processes in Parliament and try and conclude it as quickly as we practically can within this term. We wouldn't want a legislation where possible that has to lapse and then must be resuscitated in the 7th Parliament and so forth and so forth. So once more, I want to thank each and every one of you. Doctor from London, thank you. Thank you so much. I could hear the passion in you. I could hear the lecturer in you speaking there. And indeed, I can assure you, we were lectured too, and we learnt quite a lot. We really appreciate every effort. The time you have taken to present each and every one, it's truly appreciated. And to the colleagues, yes, thank you so much. We'll know what to do. So from the presenter's side and the way forward, that will conclude that portion. You are more than welcome to excuse yourself as we wrap up other housekeeping issues of the committee. So at any time, if you feel to excuse yourself, you are more than welcome to do so. My legal people there, have I summed it up? You are fine. Why, like, there is no gender sensitivity there? Only Mr. Tejana has been speaking. Okay, that was on a lighter note. Department, you've been very, very quiet. Or did I shake you by telling you that you delayed our meeting? But you did delay, that was a fact. But that doesn't mean you must be so quiet right through. We've moved over that one. But it's true. Whether you were lost or not lost, the fact is we started late because of you. But that didn't do it.
Thank you.
Please. Yeah.
Yes. No, thank you so much. No, Chair, we are very grateful to for this session. We have equally learned a lot, and I think we spend this morning opening our ears very clearly to listen to what South Africans are putting across as a way of enhancing the product that we put before the committee. So indeed, we have taken all the notes. Got a very strong team that is here. Others are listening outside, and we would have a session to then prepare for us to give feedback to the issues that have been raised. But we are very grateful to you, Chair, and indeed we apologize for having stepped in slightly, but I'm sure that we would address this in the future. Thanks so much.
I will not say much on the last part. That is okay. You wanted to say something, please go ahead.
Chairperson, for meaningful engagement next week, the department will appreciate if we can also be provided with the presentation, because in front of us we are only having written submission. We did try our level best to take notes, but I don't think it was advice. If we can also be provided with the presentation, we'll appreciate.
Follow my eyes.
Did
you follow my eyes? Did you follow my eyes? All right. That is your response. All right. But again, to the department, thank you. Thank you so much for being here. It just assists us, you know, in our process going forward. We welcome our colleagues from the other side of town. Thank you so much. Colleagues, before us, we have a minute of the test, which was last week, Tuesday. I'm putting before you for your consideration. Honorable Shalom.
Chairperson, I thought you would release the...
All of them.
Talking to ourselves.
Remember, these are public meetings. They are open. So even if you release these ones, the others who are connected are still there.
No, I want
But I hear you.
No. I'll speak after they have departed.
What do you do with those that are connected and watching you on TV?
I want exactly to know that we've got new members in our midst, and they must be accepted officially. Thank you.
Okay. Why did it need to be done when other people are gone? It's a straightforward thing. All right. Well, the rules do permit that we co-opt members when we have a reduction in numbers so that we can continue to have a quorum. And in the absence of Honorable Zwane and Honorable McDonald, no, you didn't adopt anybody, but anyway, it's fine. Those two members and colleagues.
And we proceed, Chairperson.
You started the matter, and I'm responding.
No, I don't want you to deliberate much on it. I understand what you mean.
Okay, but thank you very much. So we have co-opted those two members, and maybe so that for the record, let's ask them to hear their voices. We can see their faces. Because that's what Honorable Shabango actually wanted to say. I want to know who they are. But he was going, you know, he's my colleague, I know. They are co-opted into the committee according to the rule. But please introduce yourselves, colleagues.
Good afternoon, Chairperson, and the members of the committee. Thanks for the adoption. We're almost not. But yeah, I'm Honorable Senator Manil. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon to yourself and the Honorable Members and the support team. Chairperson, myself, I'm Pumeza Mbushe, the member of the Tourism Portfolio Committee. Siyabulela ukho odwa ke oko for today.
Thank you. We're adopting you. We needed some children. Thank you so much. But colleagues, there are the minutes of the 1st of November. Present to you for your consideration and approval. I'm sure you have gone through them. Can I have a mover? Honorable Rabadua?
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I raise my hand
to propose that we adopt this minutes. I went through the minutes. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Can I have a seconder? Honorable Shabahu?
I propose that the minutes be adopted as a true record of what transpired on that day. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. The minutes have been duly adopted. Colleagues, thank you. Thank you very much. As we wrap up, I wanted to raise two issues, really for your processing. We can talk about them next week. Firstly, I hope you are noting the amendments and the progress we are making in terms of our public participation on the rail safety bill. So please, let's take note of that. It's something that we need to fully, we don't want to go there, and we are far and we don't have members we can call to co-opt and be part of that, because we would have been very far by that time. Here it's much easier, we can call and say, please come in. But we won't be able to do it when we are sitting in Potchefstroom and call members and say, how quickly can you get here? So I'm pleading with members. I know weekends are a bit tough, there are many issues, especially those that are going towards their own conferences, they are stressed and all those things. But let's make sure that the work continues. The second one, colleagues, is that we will be having the department to make a presentation and the RTMC. If you look at the program on their plans for the festive season, I want you to consider us inviting also PRASA to give us exactly the same. PRASA is a mass mover of our people, and they tend to be very quiet as to how they are going to move people in mass during festive season safely. And so we are considering doing that. And there's also been media reports around them disposing of coaches that have rusted. For whatever reason that might be, I think as a committee we have issued a statement saying we have noted, we will invite them, because while the main Shosholoza line, the long ones, have not really been fully recaptured or brought back, we see media reports that there are coaches which were dedicated to that service being disposed of. So we want to hear what are the answers to that. So I want you just to prepare your minds in that way, so that we'll see where to squeeze it, but it has to happen before the festive season really kicks off. Because people are really suffering. We all know that during this time, people need to move with their goods and everything, and they cannot be catered for. So those are the things, colleagues, I thought I needed to bring to your attention, so that if you see us asking them, you are there. Honorable Kumalo. I didn't want to say Ndumwa and I copy Honorable Zwa. So I'll call you Honorable Kumalo.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry that I'm now speaking after you have spoken. I shouldn't be doing that. But I thought I must say this, that marching orders that we have created on all of us with relates to the issue of public hearings are very welcome. However, I think I must say in the committee members that except the second, third and fourth, that I won't be able to do, to attend due to the family commitment that will hold me at home. But on a lighter note, I must also appreciate that you only relied on these two members at the back in relation to the minutes, because it is only two of them that were present in that meeting. All of us were not there. Thank you.
It is well. Okay.
As well as adoption children that you should
Honorable Shabaru.
Chair, I might be out of order, but correction. Media asked me the intended media, that is there anything that the minister is doing without the consultation of his committee? I applied my mind and said yes. They said, how can it be? I said, according to my way of thinking, the question of potholes, Valazon was not discussed in this. And people are asking, where is Valazon? Of which we didn't discuss. Maybe I was upset when we were discussing something. I thank you.
All right, Honorable Shabangu. Well, the response you had already given, but your response was not entirely correct. Why am I saying so? Because the minister doesn't have to consult the committee on his programs of his department. He's the executing authority and the executive who must deliver what they believe is right. Ours is an oversight role over him, strictly so, and where we feel there are issues that we need to be briefed by the minister of the department, it's incumbent upon us to raise it and say we would want the minister and the department to brief us on the following issues. Mm-hmm. But the minister doesn't have to ask for permission from us or to discuss with us what they are doing in the department. It can be done as a matter of courtesy, but at the end of the day, where we pick up issues that we think we want answers to, we are well within our rights to summon the minister or anybody and say we want responses or a briefing in the following areas. So I think these things do happen, and all of us do learn along the way. But my suggestion is that where there is a particular area of interest, let us exercise our powers and rights to invite or summon whoever we need to give us answers. Whether it's Valazonke or it's Prasa coaches or it's anything, it is within our right to do so. But obviously outside the committee, in our respective political parties, we play different roles. And I'm responding now as a committee chairperson, not as a person speaking on a political party. So within your political party, obviously, I'm sure they are asking you as a member of the committee, but in your political party cap. And in that instance, because as a committee, the committee has got a way of communicating issues of the committee. I hope
Thank you, Chair. I don't want to make it a dialogue. Thank you for the explanation, but I've got a different view. Thank you very much.
thank you very much. Colleagues, thank you so much. We will meet next week, Tuesday. The meeting stands adjourned. Enjoy lunch. There are croissants served and coffee. It's 2 o'clock in the